Welcome back to Rewatchable. This is episode 345. God, that's a lot of episodes that we've done. 345. It's our 2021 Thanksgiving special, and we are recording an episode featuring the movie You've Got Mail. As you may have heard in recent weeks and months, we have been recording a few movie specials. We're doing the Matrix series as a set of three, and we're also doing a holiday special through from Thanksgiving, Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas before we get back into doing a regular weekly rewatch of a show next year. If you want to get in touch with us about what we're doing or what we've been doing lately, you can always reach out to us on social media. The email address is rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet us at re_watchable. You can join our Facebook group, Rewatchables Rewinders, and you can basically find us anywhere connected to our new home of Subjectify Media. Subjectify Media is the new website that hosts Rewatchable, Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, Not About the Weather, and Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson show that features our colleague Karen. And it is our new hub for recording and articles since the closure of the website Rewatchable originally started on Hyperball. If you want to hear more details about what happened there, it's all good. We're making a new little niche for ourselves on the internet, and you can hear a lot about it on episode 37 of our sister podcast, Not About the Weather. We'll link that in the show notes. So today on the podcast, we're joined by five people, including myself, which is a big panel, and it's actually a bit of an unusual one. So You've Got Mail is a classic rom-com from 1997 or 8. I can't remember. I think it's 98. And we've all seen it, basically. So this is it's a loose, super fanny episode where we're just getting together to rewatch this movie and talk about it, as opposed to a newbie versus super fan panel. So it's a bit of an unusual one, but we just wanted to have fun with a lovely rom-com to find a movie that had like vaguely something to do with Thanksgiving. And the group that we have here today includes Ariana, Brittany, Danielle, myself, and our friend Cass, who is a good friend of mine who has met many of our Subjectify writers in the past and has recently come on board to do a few articles and podcast episodes for us. So she might be a feature in a series in the future. She might be a special guest, but she's here today. She's also an Australian, so you're going to have to pay good attention to our fun facts if you're not able to distinguish between two different Australian accents to know who's talking, whether it's me or Cass. So getting into our fun facts. In our Halloween episode about Practical Magic, we made our fun facts a few details about our favourite Halloween TV episode. So we're repeating that theme today. We're going to give you a fun fact about our favorite Thanksgiving TV episode. So if you could carefully listen to everyone's voices, they introduce themselves, you'll be able to meet everyone on the panel and distinguish who's who. So we'll go in alphabetical order. The first person we've got here is Ariana. Ariana, can you tell us about your favorite Thanksgiving TV episode and why?
Sure. So my favorite Thanksgiving episode is from my favorite show as a teenager, Smallville. Ironically, though, as some of you know, I never watched the last season of Smallville because it made me too sad.
Yeah.
The last season, until very recently. I still haven't finished the series, but I watched like the first half. And episode 1007, Ambush, is a Thanksgiving episode where Lois's dad comes to the Kent farm for Thanksgiving, and it's really delightful. And great.
So that's a later episode. That's in the final season, is it?
Yes, it's in the final season.
So is this like a recent discovery for you, this episode?
It is a recent discovery. It's very fun. It's Lois and Clark are like officially a couple now, and her dad and sister show up for Thanksgiving, and I believe we hadn't seen them since like season 5. So it was a long time coming, but it's great to see them. She also like has a lot of trauma from her family. But it's a very good episode.
Cool. I definitely haven't heard of that one on many lists and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's a bit of an unusual one. I mean, maybe it's not for people who watch Smallville, but I was not aware that they had a special Thanksgiving episode. Brittany, how about you? Brittany's got a bit of a special relationship to Thanksgiving episodes on television, and this was a trial for her to narrow one down. So, Brittany, why don't you tell us about your chart?
My chart, the infamous chart. So last year, because of COVID, we were in lockdown, and due to me needing to be somewhere 2 weeks after Thanksgiving, I had to celebrate Thanksgiving by myself. So I decided to do what I do every year on Thanksgiving, which is rewatch all the Thanksgiving episodes of my favorite shows. I'm a big 90s and 2000s sitcom fan, and no one does a Thanksgiving episode better than, well, until we get to Cass's, does a Thanksgiving episode better than like a 90s sitcom. So I rewatch Will and Grace every single year. They've done two Thanksgiving episodes, both of which are two parts. And The West Wing also has fantastic Thanksgiving episodes. But this past year, I rewatched Thanksgiving episodes from Will and Grace, The West Wing, Bob's Burgers, which does a Thanksgiving episode almost every season, and they're always fantastic, Frasier, and Gilmore Girls. So that was my entire day. It took me from, I looked it up because Insta Stories documents everything that you've ever done in your life. So I started right after the parade with Frasier. And then I ended my evening with The West Wing, and it took from like noon until about 10 p.m. I watched just all Thanksgiving episodes of these television shows.
The first time you posted this, like the actual, like the written schedule, I was just like, this is, it's a commitment. It's amazing.
It's so just impressive.
It's just so Britney, and it's just so good. But
yeah, it's out of date now because Bob's Burgers has another Thanksgiving episode, so I need to add to it.
I assume the West Wing have ones that are like quite, you know, I know obviously Thanksgiving is like quite important at the White House, you know, red, white and royal blue taught me all about that.
There is a pardoning turkey episode.
I assume they've got some like political colonizy stuff as well in the West Wing.
I mean, the whole beginning of the episode about the pardoning of the turkeys, they are trying to write like the Thanksgiving proclamation, and they decide to come up with like a pilgrim detective series. So it's actually kind of funny. But none of the plots, there is a plot of Indians in the Lobby that is all about that. So that's one of the Thanksgiving episodes, actually.
Cool. But what was your final choice to highlight this week?
So my final choice has to, of course, be Will and Grace. And it's Lowe's in the mid-80s, so part one and part two. The gang is getting together right before Thanksgiving to go out to dinner. It's just the core four. They run into this girl who's sitting at the bar, and she's crying because she doesn't understand why her boyfriend, she thinks her boyfriend's going to break up with her, and she doesn't really understand why things are going south because they have so much in common. And the gang quickly deduces that the boyfriend is gay and dumping her because he's gay. And so they tell the story of how Will and Grace were dating, and then he comes out to her. So
yeah.
It's all about Will coming out. And then
I definitely have seen quite a lot of clips from this episode. And it's probably like one of the Will and Grace episodes I know the most about without having seen. I haven't seen it, but I feel like I know like this episode very well. Because it shows when he first meets Jack as well, right?
Yeah. So Jack, it's great because it's set obviously in the 80s, and the costuming is just so fantastic. And it shows Will and Jack's backstory. It also shows Karen wasn't involved with any of them at that point. So it shows like what she was up to, and it's hilarious. And it shows actually how she met her maid Rosario. So the decision that Karen's making in the whole plot is that she's deciding whether or not to like go with Stan, who it becomes her husband. And that's how she gets rich. So that is like a whole side plot that's happening during the episode, but she always like cuts into the story because she's like, your story's getting boring. And like, it's told very well in like a flashback way. And you find out that, like, you know, Will actually slept with a woman after he broke up with Grace. And then that comes back in one of the best episodes of Will and Grace ever created in season 6, where that woman comes to a dinner party that Grace's husband hosts. And it's so good. One of the best episodes ever. So yeah, that was my final decision.
Is it like a funny episode or is it like a sad, like, is it like an emotional episode? It's like Will and Grace breaking up. Like, is there like, cause I know there are some really heart-wrenching moments of this show. Is this like a sad one?
So, or is it kind of is, but also Debbie Reynolds is there singing in the living room. So like, it's hard to not laugh about it because it's very cut with comedy, but it is one of the more emotional episodes. There is the worst breakup on Will and Grace is when like Will and Grace like almost end their friendship like over something. So that is like, that to me is like the worst episode. I almost like never rewatch it, but this episode, it has its highs and lows, but it's very well acted and it's great. It's a great Thanksgiving episode.
We're going to go on to Cass because Cass has picked the one that Brittany was tossing up about, you know, freeing up space for Brittany to focus on Will and Grace. I know Cass has one that was on Brittany's list, so you guys can chat about that for a second. So Cass, what was your choice? I'll say Cass, again, like me, Cass is Australian, so this is all like an alien concept to us that we just know through the television, though Cass is married to an American, so has experienced several Thanksgivings. I have not, so she has more experience than me now. Yeah, but yeah, go ahead.
So the one that I chose in the end was a Bob's Burgers episode. Like Brittany said, they've done a lot of them. There's, I think, 9 or 10 at this point. But the one I chose is called Turkey in a Can. It is from season 4, episode 5. And it's basically about Bob is really excited. He's preparing a 3-day brine turkey, and he's been looking forward to it a lot. But it keeps ending up overnight. It keeps on ending up in the toilet and no one can figure out who's doing it or what's going on. And it actually ends up being a really sweet episode, despite how gross that is conceptually, which is kind of a common factor for this show. Essentially what has been happening in the end, they figure out that Bob has been sleepwalking and putting the turkey in the toilet himself because he's dreaming about a memory of potty training Tina when she was a toddler, because he's sort of anxious about her growing up. But on top of all of that stuff, I think the main reason that I love this episode so much, and I think Brittany and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, is that it is the same episode that a lot of people will have seen clips from, where Bob keeps having to go back to the butcher to get a new turkey. And the butcher thinks that Bob is interested in him. And so he keeps on saying to Bob, like, I'm not interested. I've got a boyfriend. Bob is like a nervous wreck about it, but it's all really cute. Bob ends up saying, like, trying to let him down by saying, I'm straight. I mean, I'm mostly straight. Anyway, I'm married, but if I wasn't, but maybe. And it's just all really, really cute. There's one particular line in it that just slays me every time, where the butcher is telling him, like, you know, I'm seeing somebody at the moment, but I've got this friend who's like into sloppy bears. So I'll set you up with anyway. Him.
I have seen this clip many times. I have never seen the episode. Brittany, was this your top Bob's one as well? Or
it is. I think the best thing about the Bob's Burgers Thanksgiving episodes is that Bob cares. It like should be known that Bob cares about Thanksgiving more than any other day in the calendar year. He loves cooking Thanksgiving dinner. He's very dedicated to the turkey, as this episode shows. This one's my favorite because I think it's like, I agree with what Cass was saying. Like, there's always these like touching, really, like really touching moments, like Bob being like so anxious about Tina growing up that like are so devastating. But I mean, there are a couple other ones that I like on like an equal plane. And the other one that I was in contention with is when Bob has to leave his precious turkey in the hands of his not capable family to go yes. pick up Linda's sister, Gail, and take her cat, Mr. Business, with them. And it's snowing and he can't drive. So he has to like drag her on a sled. It's like, it's very good. And he just wants like Linda to put the phone to the turkey to say it's going to be okay, that he's on his way back. But yeah, I think that Bob's Burgers is up there as one of my all-time favorite shows, just for those moments that are just like so touching out of nowhere that you're like, wow, I care about this family more than my own almost. They're so great. I'm rooting for them to just have it all.
I really haven't watched much of it, but the bisexual butcher scene I have seen probably 25 times on Twitter. So
yeah,
it's my main experience of Bob's Burgers. And I really, even just the cadence of it, like things haven't been great with Tony. They haven't been great with Tony for a long time. Like just the devolvement of it. It's very funny, funny in a bubble. So I assume it's better tracked throughout the show, like throughout the episode. Okay, Danielle, how about you? What is your Thanksgiving episode of choice?
Ooh, well, we're about to take a turn.
very depressing.
Oh, you know, okay. Unlike Brittany, I feel like my favorite shows have never had Thanksgiving episodes. So like when we were discussing this, the only show that came to mind, I think, is one that you're covering, Natalie. And even then, like, I didn't know exactly which episodes it was. So the one that came to mind after that is from Gossip Girl. It's in the very first season. It's season 1, episode 9, Blair Waldorf Must Pie. And it sticks out to me because it's like, you know, Thanksgiving is not fun for me. And so it sticks out because this, I think, was one of the first shows that I had seen that didn't show Thanksgiving as being like a fun,
wholesome and
holiday. Like, yeah. Like
it showed like stress of holiday.
Stress. I really hope nobody who's from my family is listening, but like not wanting to be near maybe your family for this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was nice to see that rather than like everyone is happy to be together and maybe they get into hijinks and they get mad and they come back together. And everybody has like fancy plates. It's like, no. So, I mean, Gossip Girl very much did have fancy plates, but in this episode, like, Blair's very fancy plates. Blair's world is like falling apart because of family drama. And I think there was stuff happening with like Serena and Dan as well. So it was nice to see a dysfunctional, very, very dysfunctional family on this holiday. And that's the one that sticks out to me.
Yeah, I think that that's really valid because, you know, when I was looking up like movies for us to potentially do like a Thanksgiving movie, most of the movies that are actually about Thanksgiving, because You've Got Mail is not about Thanksgiving. There is a scene set on Thanksgiving over the fall period of the show, but it's not like about everyone going home for the holidays. There are movies like that that are on the list of ones that I chose. Most of them are more like what you described, Danielle. They're like, you know, forced family interactions where something's going to blow up and it's not going to be in a rom-com way, if you know what I mean. Like The Ice Storm was one of the ones that we looked at, and Home for the Holidays with Robert Downey Jr. And there are lots of movies that are like that deal with that whole like obligation family holiday that is quite traumatic or stressful.
Yep, that'll be me in about 4 or 5 days.
And that's like super valid and super true to most people's experience. I think for doing this episode of Rewatchable, we kind of didn't want to like do trauma today.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I'm all here for welcome. But it is,
I do find that kind of like portrayal interesting when it comes to holiday episodes, like you know, whether it's Christmas or Thanksgiving. And I think in American TV, like Thanksgiving seems to be like more of a bigger deal for that. And, you know, it's kind of obviously like conflict of interest, family members, maybe like, you know, being forced to play nice with people that they really would rather not have anything to do with, or like, you know, even just the stress of trying to like, the stress of preparing something being like not the payoff for how good the thing actually is. Like, I think there's a lot of interesting storytelling that can be done with that kind of thing. So yeah, I'm glad to have one of those on the list here.
I am happy to provide it.
Mine is back to the rom-com sitcom. My number one that I can recall that I really feel passionately about is the first New Girl Thanksgiving episode. So episode 106, it's just called Thanksgiving. They also do a lot of Thanksgiving episodes, but this one was the first one, and it was really nice in a lot of ways. Like, it was Jess's first Thanksgiving in the loft. All of the boys didn't care. They were like, yeah, we just want to watch TV and then go to Black Friday sales. We don't care. And she kind of forced this family loft dinner, and they invited Justin Long, Paul Genslinger, who was one of Jess's like main first boyfriends on the show. And they weren't dating yet. And even though New Girl has the endgame pairing of Jess and Nick that was like very clear from very early on in the show, I always really loved the way that Jess and Nick supported each other's relationships. Like, even though, you know, they got together later and they even broke up again and dated other people, and they were still like quite supportive of that. And it was kind of really nice to see, for me, number one, Nick kind of being like, what the hell is with this guy, Paul? And then like ending up actually like really liking him, even though like there was nothing between him and Jess at that point. So, you know, Paul Genslinger comes into the fold and he's like really liked by everyone. Eventually, you know, him and Nick go out on errands and they end up basically making it so that he can get to Black Friday with them. And they basically like Jess, everything gets messed up with Jess. Of course, there's like a turkey cooking incident. They end up putting it in the tumble dryer. They find a dead body in the building. Like, there's all this drama, but all of the others get together to help Jess basically not have blown it with Paul, who is a teacher at the school she teaches at, who was alone for Thanksgiving as well. And it's just a really cute little romance episode for her, but it also has the side plot. This is about six episodes in for the whole series. It also has the side plot of Schmidt and Cece, which is like it's one of the first episodes where you really start seeing how like OCD Schmidt is, like how genuinely weird he is, as opposed to being like sleazy and stuff. Schmidt is one of my favorite characters in all of fiction, and the way that his character was done kind of started out as this like playboy character, and then you know, they took a perfectly good playboy look at it. It's got anxiety, and this was one of the first episodes where you basically kind of see him getting really stressed about things, because even though he like really loves Cece already, like he's basically already in it, she doesn't have very good cooking standards, and like they are assigned to make the sides together, and he like starts getting like really fucking stressed and angry at her about her chopping things wrong or touching things with her hands instead of gloves or washing. And she's kind of like, oh my God, I think I'm into him, because of the fact that he's being like bossy and neurotic. And so the neurotic Schmidt side is another big favorite episode for me. I'll also give a shout out to Buffy season 4 Pangs, which I won't like talk too much about, but we recorded an episode about when we did the Buffy rewatch, obviously. That's a great episode where, again, it's kind of a stressful episode for Buffy, because she is trying really hard to be normal and wanting to basically just cook a Thanksgiving dinner for all her friends and not be the Slayer, and all this stuff gets messed up. Xander accidentally wakes up a Native American tribal leader who comes and haunts them. And it's also, you know, it's actually quite sensitive about the whole Native American colonization thing. But it also is one of the first episodes where we get Spike in the fold with the Scoobies. Like, he's just gotten the chip from the initiative, and he ends up spending Thanksgiving at Giles's house tied to a chair. And it's one of the first episodes where you really kind of see how good it's going to be that he is in the fold with the main characters. So I know that a couple of you guys have seen that episode, might have picked that episode. Cass, that might have been one on your list.
Yeah, yeah, that one was definitely on my list.
Do you have any thoughts about that one?
I do. I just wrote down one quote, which is an Anya quote. She says, to commemorate a past event, you kill and eat an animal. It's a ritual sacrifice with pie.
Yeah, that's fine. You made a bear, undo it. That was a good one. Brittany, were you on that episode for Buffy? Did you record for that one? Do you remember?
I feel like I must have because I don't know. I'll look up the show notes, but I feel like I did. Yeah. Because it's a very good episode.
Yeah, that's the thing as well. People don't really like season 4 of Buffy, but this is a very good episode of season 4 of Buffy and of Buffy in general. So it's definitely worth the rewatch in my book. And again, like for me, it's like the spike of it all, like bringing him into the fold for the Scoobies, like early on in season 4. And yeah, there's, you know, Anya, it's a really good ensemble episode, and we really love that. So yeah, that was a really good one. And we'll move on now to You've Got Mail, which again is not specifically about Thanksgiving, but it is about New York in the fall, and there is a Thanksgiving scene, and we've just decided to do it because we want to. So in You've Got Mail, Meg Ryan plays an adorable bookshop owner trying to keep her mother's legacy alive while dating Greg Kinnear by day and messaging an anonymous internet stranger by night. This internet stranger turns out to be none other than Tom Hanks, the charismatic trust fund tycoon who's running her out of business with his family's Fox Books superstore. Antics ensue, daisies are delivered, true love blossoms. So, yeah, basically that's a recap of You've Got Mail. We're going to get into the themes and talking points about You've Got Mail. The first one I wanted to say, and I didn't actually end up writing it in the doc, I got it in my phone, is this is a very interesting movie to me because it is kind of a really clever adaptation. This is a movie that has existed, the storyline has existed for a long time through plays and books, starting with a French novel, or it might have been a play called Parfumerie, and then it was made into a movie called Shop Around the Corner in the 40s. And then it was also made into a Broadway show called She Loves Me, which was revived relatively recently, that has Zach Levi as the lead. But basically all of these stories, it's the same plot. It is two competing business owners who anonymously in some way are writing letters to each other and then discover that they're enemies in real life. I wanted to ask if anyone was aware of that or if they had seen any of the other adaptations, like that this was not an original, this is an that You've Got Mail is an adaptation, and it's like a modern adaptation using the internet instead of, I don't know how they started writing notes. Brittany specifically, I wondered if you ever saw She Loves Me or anything like that. Does anyone know that this is the history of this movie, basically?
Yeah, I mean, I'd heard of The Shop Around the Corner, but yeah. I haven't seen any of the others. Actually, I didn't know that The Shop Around the Corner was an adaptation as well.
Yeah, so The Shop Around the Corner was an American adaptation, I guess, of this Hungarian play. It was a Hungarian play called Parfumerie, 1937, and then in the movies, the play was about, the same thing, two employees. I think in some it's they work at the same shop, and some they're competitors, but it's two people who hate each other in real life in a workplace environment who somehow fall in love via messaging each other in letters and stuff. And yeah, Shop Around the Corner. And then, yeah, I think the most famous one in contemporary times is She Loves Me, because it was revived in like relatively recently. It was revived in recent times. It was like
2016.
Yeah. Am I wrong about it being Zach Levi? Was it?
No, it is.
It was in here, mm-hmm. And She Loves Me. And did they broadcast that at all? I can't remember.
Yeah, so that, I didn't see it live. I actually have like I was working at a theater production company at the time where it, it came out. And around Tony time, they sent out like a ton of stuff to like all these like producers and Tony voters. And there were people in my office who were producers. And so I have a like, a vanilla ice cream cone stress ball. But anyway, you can probably watch it on like PBS. It was filmed for like the Masterpiece Theater. Mm. So I didn't see it live, but I have seen it on, what is it called? I think it's Masterpiece Theater. I don't even know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've seen it on PBS and Great Performances. That's what it is.
Yeah. So She Loves Me is actually, I just want to, before we get into the movie, you want to sort of see, yeah, I wanted to ask you because I wanted to compare. She Loves Me is actually an adaptation of Perfumery directly. It's not Shop Around the Corner, which was a different kind of business. This is actually a musical of what the original play was. And I'm just wondering how you feel like that, like plot-wise compared to You've Got Mail. Like how adapted is it, if you know what I mean? Like how much, what is the elements that you think has really transferred, and what I guess is like, how loose is it basically? If you compared She Loves Me to You've Got Mail.
I think if you didn't know going into either or that they were based on something like that has the same root, you wouldn't walk away from She Loves Me being like, that's very familiar. I'm pretty sure it's You've Got Mail. Like I think that they're not, the plot elements are very similar, but there's like, you know, it's a different time period. So there's like, they're getting love letters and they're obviously in competition with one another, but it doesn't feel the same at all to me, at least. And I think that is in part to something that we're going to talk about a little bit later, which is like the setting. Like, I feel like the time period for each of these, as well as the locations, like She Loves Me is a play. You're in like an enclosed space. You're in the shops, but You've Got Mail. You're all over the place, but you're in New York. So it's like, it's very, if you didn't know, I don't think you would draw a direct line from A to B.
Yeah. It's just sort of a similar trope with anonymous letters. Okay, cool. Interesting. All right, so we'll get into the film then. This is a movie that's written and directed by the rom-com queen Nora Ephron. So she's both the screenwriter and the director. This is a really classic Nora Ephron movie. So does anyone else have a favorite Nora Ephron movie that's not this one, or is this everyone's favorite? You know, what do we like about Nora? Arianna, why don't you start?
Well, I love Nora. I think that she's written the two best rom-coms ever made.
Okay.
I think When Harry Met Sally is probably the best rom-com ever. And I feel like it's pretty widely considered the best rom-com.
I've never seen it.
Oh my gosh, Natalie, it's so good. It's never so good. Billy Crystal's hot in it, which is a weird thing to say.
Very weird. I just saw it for the first time, I think like a month or two ago.
It's that white sweater when they're sitting looking at the rug. Yeah. I can't get over it.
The king of sweaters. But You've Got Mail is very much, I feel like, doesn't get like the same amount of respect. like the big Nora Ephron movie with Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks is Sleepless in Seattle.
Also never seen it.
And like that one got nominated for an Academy Award and stuff for her writing.
Really?
As did When Harry Met Sally. Mm-hmm. But Sorry, oh. Could you hear my cats playing with the...
I'm like, is that a bird? Hi,
kitty. It's a bird toy. But they're just agreeing with me. They're agreeing with me that... yeah, so Sleepless in Seattle is like the serious rom-com, like the one that is
And that's claimed. Also Meg and Tom, obviously. This is Meg and Tom 5 years ago, and then You've Got Mail is, you know, is late 90s. Yeah.
Yeah, so that one is, I think, early 90s or late 80s, and it's fine.
Sleepless is 93, When Harry Met Sally is 89. This movie, You've Got Mail, is 98. So, yeah.
Yes. So I like Sleepless in Seattle. I think it's fine, but I much prefer You've Got Mail. Like, for me, that's the classic that I love from Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks. And it doesn't get as much respect, but maybe because it's the second one they made. But yeah. I really love it. I feel like When Harry Met Sally is the perfect friends to lovers rom-com. And this one, I think, is the perfect enemies to lovers rom-com. It's hard to think of a better one for me personally.
And so Meg Ryan made When Harry Met Sally in the late 80s. She made this in the late 90s. Does she not age or something? Like, I don't understand, like, what happened there? Like, she obviously, When Harry Met Sally tracks a long period of time as well. It's funny. I don't know how they kind of handled that, but yeah.
It's funny you should say that, because first of all, yes, obviously she still looks gorgeous even today. But I was thinking while watching this, I was like, oh, you can actually see like her wrinkles. Like, it looks like she's aged naturally in a really beautiful way, which I feel like people don't do anymore. Like this was still pre-Botox times. And I was like, oh, she looks like a real person still. That's so nice.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure how old her and Tom were meant to be in this, like mid-30s or something, but yeah, it was cute. It was definitely nice. Brittany, how about you? Do you have a preference from the Efron backstory? The Efron back catalog?
So I agree with Ariana that When Harry Met Sally is like, that's what I think of when I think of Nora Ephron first and foremost. And then I would put You've Got Mail. I also enjoy Hanging Up, but not many people have seen it, but I see everything that Diane Keaton has ever done in her life. So I like that movie as well, but I am not a huge fan of Sleepless in Seattle. It kind of drags for me. But yeah, I think not a lot of people talk about You've Got Mail, but not in like ways that I feel connected to You've Got Mail. So it's interesting. She's got a nice catalog.
Cass and Danielle, do you have any particular feelings about the older ones? For me, this is really probably the only one that I have like a good, real solid relationship with.
I mean, I quote When Harry Met Sally probably every day of my life. Anytime I pick up pepper, I like always I'm saying I've got too much pepper. Like, it's I love When Harry Met Sally. I watched it about 2 weeks ago. I probably watched it about a month ago. Like, I watch it a lot. So yeah, that's definitely my favorite of the Nora Ephron.
I did not know that.
Movies, yeah. I mean, I love Nora Ephron movies, and yeah, Sleepless in Seattle I love as well. I love You've Got Mail. I literally love all of them. I actually own a hat that says filmed and directed by Nora Ephron. So.
What? Just like merch for
it's films? Just a Nora Ephron. Yeah, it's a Nora Ephron hat. It's a fan hat. But yeah, I literally quote When Harry Met Sally every day. So I'd be lying if I said that was not my favorite of her films.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Danielle, how about you?
I mean, for me, she is a giant blind spot. So You've Got Mail is the only one that I had really seen. And I think it was really only in parts, like walking in and out of rooms that my mom was watching it in. I have seen The End of Sleepless in Seattle for the same reason. And like I said, I just watched When Harry Met Sally for the first time, maybe a couple months ago. And I think because I came to it so late, I did not really enjoy it. Mostly because like, I don't like things that make me uncomfortable. And like the big scene that everyone knows from that is purposefully supposed to make you uncomfortable. And it's them making like this orgasm noises in the middle of the restaurant. I cannot do that kind of comedy. So it like, I think if it would have endeared itself to me, like if I'd seen it earlier, I would have liked it more. So by default, You've Got Mail is my favorite.
Cass, do you remember the ad? I think it was like for Special K, like Australian Kellogg's ad in the mid 90s that was spoofing that scene.
I do remember it. It was not Kellogg's. It was for bread.
Are you
Helga's.
Sure?
I'm
99%. No, it was not. Helga's didn't even exist then.
I could have sworn it was Helga's
so
bread.
In this country, I don't know, maybe it was dubbed maybe America did this as well, but we had that scene, like the I'll Have What She's Having orgasm scene on television here as an advertisement, like a spoof of that scene when Cass and I were kids. Like they had it, it was like, you know, the person was eating the product and basically doing that, like having those orgasm noises while eating, and I'll have what she's having. So that was like a casual primetime ad in television on here when I was growing up. So that would have been my first. And I didn't know that it was from the movie. Like I would have seen that ad. Well, I haven't seen it, still haven't seen the movie, but like it took me many years to understand that ad was a spoof. And did America ever do things like that with a spoof of that scene or anything like that?
I don't think that would fly
in America.
I feel like really? I've seen something like that before though.
I really want to see it was Kellogg's Corn Play, not Kellogg's Special K, but I can't remember. It was
I mean, that would be very counterproductive for a cereal that was invented to stop people from canoodling.
The cornflakes.
That is no way the most sexual or weird ad that we've had on television in Australia. The smads that we've had in Australia that you guys just, I don't know how you would have coped. Cass, you know what I'm talking about.
I do.
Yeah. Sorry, it's just the most sexual ad in my childhood was it was an ad for this brand of underwear. I think they literally were like called like Ants Pants or something, like women's underwear. Like not even lingerie, kind of like you know your traditional like plain underwear. And it was basically, because they were called Ants Pants, it was like a woman. It was like this sexily shot scene. Sorry, this is so not relevant to the episode, but I have to tell you now. It was and I just want to know how America would have responded to ads like this. It's this like sexually shot, like she was lying on the bed. It was like a sexy ad, like, oh, I'm in the bed in underwear and it's, you know, gold lighting and stuff. And you see that she's got like ants crawling all over her body, like all over up her legs and stuff, like trails of ants. And then you have this echidna. You know, guys know what an echidna is?
This is a concerning amount of silence.
No.
You don't know. It's an Australian native animal. It's like an anteater. It's a bit like, it's about the size of a hedgehog, but it's got a flicky tongue like an anteater, like a long, it eats ants and it flicks the tongue out. I can't believe you guys don't know what an echidna is. This is really embarrassing. The point is, you see the echidna crawling up. She's calling the echidna, that's her pet. You see it like crawling up onto the bed and crawling up towards her body, and it like cuts away, and then you hear her being like basically like making orgasm noises because she's dropped the ants all over herself so the echidna would eat them off her body and lick them up. I'm sorry for telling you guys this. I'm sorry that I had to see this so many times as a child.
I am intrigued. But
it's on the internet. It's like, I've seen it come up as like, what the fuck was going on with ads in the 90s in Australia? So
yeah, I actually just
Harry
found
Met Sally ad was mild.
I did just find the When Harry Met the ad you were talking about. It was Kellogg's. You were right. It was for Just Right.
Oh, Just Right.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. I had a feeling it was Kellogg's, but okay. We'll link the Kellogg's ad in the show notes and move on swiftly from
the ad
because that was, you guys don't really fly with that kind of stuff. But, yeah, that orgasm scene was first brought to me by Kellogg's cereal. So that was my introduction to Nora Ephron, basically. What sets a rom-com apart for you guys? Like, what makes it a really good movie rather than just like a cheesy romance? Like, what needs to happen in a rom-com? What qualities does it have to really, like, really feel like engaging and be top tier? Like, for me, like, I also really like Nancy Meyers rom-coms as well. Like, I actually probably know more of hers than Nora Ephron's. But what is it that sets movies apart? And, you know, we can use this one as an example. Like, I'm not even necessarily talking about like how the romance gets together or the chemistry, though obviously that's the number one key, is like the circumstances and chemistry of the people. What makes a rom-com a good movie to you guys? Ariana, do you have like strong feelings about what it needs to be?
I do. I have really strong feelings. I also feel like this is a loaded question because all of my answers are going to be, my answers are all related to questions we're supposed to ask later, but I'll just answer them now.
No, it's fine. I mean, you could use other movies if you like as an example.
No, but I do think that this is like a good example of what I feel is like a perfect rom-com. Mm. It's like the writing is, first of all, so good. All of her jokes are actually funny.
That's the thing. Yeah, what about the writing? Because I'm trying to lock into like, why is it good? Like
Mindy Kaling says that the fault of most rom-coms is that they're neither funny nor romantic, yeah. Which is the whole point of a rom-com. But this is genuinely funny. Like, Nora Ephron is a funny person, so the writing is funny, and it's also really well paced. Like, it's kind of it's kind of like five little mini movies within one. So many different things are happening. And there's so many like beginnings and endings within this movie, but it still feels like it has a really nice arc to it. Also, like, you believe that the people are falling in love, which I think is really hard for a rom-com to do. Most rom-coms I watch because I want to believe that, but you don't actually, I feel like it's not fully seen on screen, which I think is really hard to do within 2 hours.
You're just told that they are.
Yes. And in this one, you get to watch it. I also feel like casting is super important, which we're going to talk about later. But I mean, the casting in this is great. And I feel like specifically with the leading man, like if it was almost anyone else, it wouldn't work. So casting, I think, is really essential.
Danielle, do you watch a lot of rom-coms, or you're more of a Karen in this department? By the way, we don't mean like a Karen, manager Karen. We mean our Karen.
Two different Karens. Karen is in a league of her own. I am not in Karen's league. I do now watch a lot of rom-coms, but I feel like they're more in the like Britney arena in terms of like the Hallmark movies. Or they're in the late 90s, early 2000s teen rom-coms.
Yeah, like a YA.
That's rom-com. My sweet spot. Like, She's All
What's
That.
What's your favorite YA? Like a high school one.
Oh, God. I mean, I always go back to She's All That, which is, like, problematic.
Did you watch the remake?
I did not. I have saved myself that headache. But like, those are the ones that I would watch. And I feel like Ariana's points are all very much there. Like, the casting is the biggest thing. Like, if I don't believe that these people have any sort of chemistry, then I'm not here for it. I mean, we saw, this is not a rom-com, but recently, like with the Eternals, everyone's talking about how they focused on the wrong couple, because that couple that was the focus of the movie had like no chemistry, whereas there was one on the periphery that very much did, and they got zero time. So I think
they'll get their own movie.
But, I hope so. I think they will.
But I mean,
that's it. I think that's the most important.
Yeah. Side note. I mean, I wrote about this in my Eternals review, but like I kind of loved that the couple in Eternals that you were meant to quote unquote focus on was like, it was a smokescreen. I kind of loved that they sold the movie on it being this romance between them, but what actually happened was like not that. But it was kind of like by the end, I was like, oh, thank God, I'm not meant to be rooting for them. Basically, that's kind of how the Eternals romance made me feel. And that's kind of the opposite of what you want in a rom-com. But I was just basically relieved that we were not actually meant to be rooting for them in any way. So maybe the lack of chemistry was on purpose. It's like 5,000 years of being together doesn't mean they're actually good together. But I don't know. I tend to really like rom-coms about older people. I love teen movies, but I tend to love, like, I really like old people movies. Like Something's Gotta Give.
Nancy Myers?
Yeah, like Something's Gotta Give is a classic one, but I like a lot of British, like, old people movies as well. I like college movies. I like mid-30s movies, and I always have. Like, when I was a teenager, one of my favorite movies in the world was this movie called The Last of the Blonde Bombshells, which is a basically rom-com between Judi Dench and Ian Holm, who at the time were about 60, and it was about, like, how they'd played in a brass band together during World War II as teenagers and reconnected as adults to get the swing band back together to play a concert for Judi Dench's granddaughter. And it's, like, a sexy, cool, funny, getting the gang back together rom-com about old people. And this has been one of my favourite movies since I was 15 years old. So that's, like, a real, really weird, like, niche that I've always fallen into. I feel like what really counts for me is like everything outside the romance. Like the romance has to work. That's not even a question. It has to be chemistry. You have to kind of feel like this is like just meant to be, and there has to be contention for me. Like I love movies about people being friends and getting along, but I kind of love movies about people when there's like a lot of conflict. For me, what really sets it apart is what happens around the couple. Like, this movie, for example, you've got male. Every line in the movie is killer. Like, between whoever is talking, like between her shop assistants, his family, every single line in the movie is like really painting a great picture of established relationships and characters within a life. One I really love is actually Elizabeth Merriweather, who created New Girl, wrote that movie with Ashton Kutcher, and it's called No Strings Attached, I think. Did you guys see that one?
Yes.
Mindy Kaling's in it. Yeah. That, I think, is like a top-tier rom-com for that. It's like everyone in that movie is like a whole person. Every line is hilarious, even if it's incidental. And so that's a real top tier one for me. And I just need like everything to feel real, I guess, like not just puppets moving around this couple. But yeah. Brittany, I wanted to know if you could you love the Hallmark holiday season and all of that. And we're getting a lot of kind of like that. I feel like movies that are like halfway between your classic sharp, clever rom-com like this, halfway between that and like the most basic Lifetime Christmas movie in terms of like Netflix Christmas movies. Some of them have no inner life and they're just complete duds. And they're just like, you know, we're going to go and save the farm again. And some of them are like, great. So where do you fall like with how you feel about a rom-com like this versus like a Hallmark movie, Brittany? Like, what are the highs and lows, or what's the difference?
So there's one major thing that I think stands out with how they actually both hit what I like about romance movies. And Hallmark movies are not rom-coms, like not even close, because they're not funny and they're just not really well written. Yeah, and the romances are not believable. But one of the things that I like about When Harry Met Sally, even Sleepless in Seattle and You've Got Mail, is I don't like when they're together. I feel like you want that kiss at the end of the movie. I don't want to see them together in any sort of romantic capacity until the payoff at the end. And I think that that tension is what gets me. And if the characters can play that tension and play it so well, even if they don't know that they're playing that tension, like, yes, in this film, like, Tom Hanks is keyed into it earlier than Meg Ryan. And I love that conceit of the plot, like that he knows a little bit more, but this like foundational friendship makes you believe,
crave it.
Yeah. And crave it more. And it makes you, it makes the romance more believable because it's like, oh, we fell into bed together. Like, yeah, there's some films that work like that, but my favorite,
no, I mean, like I said, No Strings Attached is obviously that's a Friends with Benefits to love movie. Yeah. And I really like that.
I like the payoff in the end. And I think it's because you're getting the relationship of these two people. Like,
yeah.
What happens when kissing doesn't solve everything.
I think that pacing thing is like quite important. And it's interesting because like we've talked a bit about Hallmark movies. When we did that episode talking about, we talked about how like Hallmark, I think when we talked, Cass, you might've been on this episode. This might've been the episode where we talked about fandom.
Yeah.
We were talking about how Hallmark movies are similar to fan fiction in that they pay off, they're like a safe space where you know the thing is going to happen. I mean, not obviously not all fan fiction ends happily, but like you can choose to go into a fan fiction that's tagged in a way where you know it's going to end happily and you know it's going to be this burn to a romance that they get together at the end. We've talked about that comparison between Hallmark style movies and rom-coms in general and the safety of fan fiction in how you kind of go in prepared for the experience that you're going to have, like knowing the payoff is there at the end. And we were talking about this recently with a friend of ours who's writing fan fiction for the first time, who had some, she's very good, but she had some comments being like, oh, such misunderstandings. Oh, I hope once it gets resolved, you get a few more chapters of them just being together happily. And Cass and I were both like, no. our friend wasn't doing that either, but we were just like, no, this is like, this is someone who doesn't understand like the story structure, like that you think you want that, but reading it will be boring basically. Yeah. Like just, do you know what I mean?
It's just all the wind knocks out, it gets knocked out of the sails.
All of the tension of the thing gets knocked out of your sails. The most I want from that in a movie is like a montage in the end credits showing bits of story of what happens next. You know what I mean? Like when a movie does that in the end credits.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like that little kind of vignette at the end. So I think I agree with you, Brittany, about like the tension and not seeing them together earlier. Though I think there are good stories that are about relationships not getting perfect, but do follow them being together. Again, Red, White and Royal Blue is kind of like that. Like it's like they're together, but the conflict is sort of external to that, I guess.
Brittany, that was such a good answer. I just wanted to say that's an amazing answer. And I think you're spot on. I like that is what makes a rom-com work. It also reminded me, like going off of tension, I also feel like longing is really important. And like, for example, like Love Sick, which I think is such a good series rom-com, does that really well. But I think especially in like heterosexual rom-coms like this is, I feel like longing from the man, like seeing that he loves her just a little bit more, I feel like is...
than she knows about.
I feel like it's really good.
So yeah, how many of you guys have seen Love Sick now?
Oh, I mean, I've seen it multiple times.
I've watched it. I have not seen it.
Well, it was just one of our shows that was on the list to do for Rewatchable, but I think at the first time Ariana suggested it, like only she had seen it. And so we didn't have enough super fans. And I'm wondering if we now have enough super fans to do it.
I think so.
Okay. Interesting. To be continued later.
I just wanted to comment on Ariana's point about the longing and it coming from the male perspective. And I think this is also like feeds into why I like some of like the period dramas a lot more too, especially like Emma. Like Emma is a rom-com at the end of the day, if no matter which adaptation you watch, if you watch it in like a 6-part miniseries or you watch the most recent one, because Lovesick reminded me of it actually. But there's just so much like longing watching this guy watch this woman do everything in her power to set everybody else up in her life and is like neglecting her own romance. And it's like, there's that tension of like, they need to be together. They're finally realizing that they're going to be together. And then they dance and their hands touch and oh my God, the world's going to end because their hands touch. Like, I love that like build up of something like to be something so small, but you have are so invested in these people that you're just like, oh my God, yes.
So you guys, so, you know, we've got Ariana in terms of Emma, Ariana versus Brittany. Who do you think's the better knightly
between Johnny Lee Miller? Johnny Lee Miller, hands down. There's no one better. Yeah.
He's a really great knightly. I really like the newest one. I don't Johnny know why. Flynn. Yes, Johnny Flynn.
Isn't he the star of Lovesick, or is he not?
He is the star of Lovesick.
That's why I'm asking. Like, yeah, so who's gonna win in the Pokemon battle between you guys?
I'll let Brittany have Johnny Lee Miller. He is really good. But I do think that Johnny Flynn is very good also.
Yeah, Johnny Flynn is a very good knightly, but I think Johnny Lee Miller was young enough to pull off this like just baby faced. There's some scenes that I just like cannot even watch. They're just so good. Oh, I love it.
Well, skipping ahead from the Regency era, one of the things that sets You've Got Mail apart from basically any other movie is like it's such a snapshot of a period of time, because it is one of the first movies about internet dating, certainly the first movie about the internet that I ever really remember seeing. Like, I cannot remember seeing another movie where the central premise hinged on the internet in a time when the internet wasn't that normal. Like, this movie came out when I was about 12, I think. And I don't remember if I saw it at the cinema or if I saw it a couple of years later, but I would have seen it like relatively early on. And, you know, this is definitely the era that I started using the internet personally. I don't know if everyone here was like a late 90s internet user or if it was a bit later for you guys. And I just think it's an interesting snapshot of that time period where it wasn't normal to just meet people on the internet. Let alone internet dating. It wasn't like they were set up into, it wasn't like they actually met trying to date on the internet. It was just, I'm going on the internet to go in a chat room randomly to talk about life and like, I'm just going to connect with random people. It doesn't have an aim for dating. That was definitely my first experience of the internet as well. I didn't have AOL. We didn't have that server. But like, did any of you guys ever use ICQ? Do you guys remember that?
It sounds familiar.
It was an app. It was a program where you could just basically either enter chat rooms or you could randomly cycle through profiles. Like, you had a profile and it was an instant messaging platform, and you would just either search people by like topics in their profile, hit a random button into chat rooms. If you knew someone in real life, you could add them if they told you your handle, and then you could just use it to instant message. So I definitely had friends I instant message on ICQ, but also completely like random hitting the profile and like cycle and like connecting with people. Like, you could choose to set a location or not set a location, and it was like that. And I'm sure that people met from it for sex or dating, but it wasn't like I was about to say banter. It wasn't like a Grindr or like a Tinder situation. It wasn't aimed at that. It was just aimed at, we've got the internet and we can just talk to people. Did you guys ever just talk to people on the internet when you were in, I mean, obviously we were younger than Tom and Meg, but did you guys ever just talk to people?
Yeah. Yeah. I probably started a few years after seeing this movie, but I think I saw it around when it came out as well. So I was probably 14 or 15 when I just, you know, would go onto random chat rooms and just talk to complete strangers about anything and everything. And I remember seeing this movie, like I said, quite early, and not sort of making the connection at the time, but looking back, just sort of thinking that I really feel like Nora Ephron, or I guess maybe Delia, who co-wrote it, they must have had some close internet friendships, because they do seem to, they really sort of nail what internet friendships and internet relationships are like.
In what way?
The way that you sort of cut through to the deep down stuff before you really know what someone does for a living.
Yeah, like basically skip the small talk. Yeah.
Yeah.
And just be like, yeah, here, because sometimes it is easier to just talk about like really intense stuff, whether it's random or whether it's like personal, when there is absolutely no conception of the person knowing your context of life. Like, you know, that someone, they know everything about you. So if you want to talk about something that would be like a shock to them to hear that you think that way, it's like weird, but like a stranger, you could just be like, yeah, I want to talk about this thought that I've never had before. I don't know. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
And it definitely was sort of, this movie was saying, you know, you had other characters who were like, that's weird that you do that. Like, it was so not normalized in any way. And it was a unique time for the internet because it was really anonymous. Today, everyone's online, but they're mostly online as themselves. I mean, yeah, sure, people can stay anonymous on the internet, but like, it's not about that anonymity. It's not about being anonymous, really. Like, people have social media and their profiles are mainly known who they are, or they're kind of willing to have a public identity, whether their real name is on it or not. It's not about that kind of random element. I don't even know if chat rooms still exist. Like, you know, if you wanted to go and talk about Only Murders in the Building or something, like fan forums obviously were a similar thing, like that got built. Fan forums came from that kind of thing where you could, you know, get a chat room that was themed about a topic like the X-Files or whatever, and then maybe some people would be like, I'm going to take an initiative to go and build a GeoCities site and we can all go there and post things about our ideas, you know, like you could just connect. And it's sort of more randomly than going on Twitter, and I guess it's similar to like searching a hashtag on Twitter and trying to just chat to people there. But the big difference between that, sorry, I'm really rambling. The big difference between that, today's social media, and what an AOL chat room was, or even a forum, is that everything today is personal profile based. So if not just I'm anonymous or not, but if I search a supernatural hashtag and someone has an opinion that I want to reply to, what I'm doing is I'm coming into their house and I'm screaming it in their face if I reply to them. It's not a public forum, and certainly on something like Tumblr, it's not a public forum in the way that we've all come to the supernatural. There's a chat about supernatural going on in the school gym, and we've all come to the gym, and anyone can say what they want about supernatural in the school gym. We've all joined the chat room to talk about this thing. It's different from someone being like posting that stuff on their own profile-based page, because if you reply to them, you're then confronting them in their own space. And it wouldn't necessarily have to be negative, but it's still, I'm coming into your space to talk to you rather than we have joined a space together. Some people do see Twitter as that level of public space. I personally do not see it that way. And certainly Tumblr, which is where a lot of the social media stuff changed for random like connections with people via hashtags, that's definitely coming into someone's space if you need to reply to what they're saying. So I don't know. It's weird the way that the internet has changed. Did you guys have an early relationship with the internet, Ariana or Brittany or Danielle? You guys are a couple of years younger than me, but what was your early internet experience like?
So I wasn't on it at the same time this movie was coming out because I was 8.
Yeah.
And I don't think I had any sort of login. I think I got my, well, I know that I got my first email address when I was 11 because my first email address and AOL screen name was FluteAngel11. Still out there somewhere. So like I wasn't doing that. But I think I did start like building sites at some point or just kind of knew about it from being in school, because in school we were very tech forward, I think, especially for our school district. So I was kind of up on it. And so like, I feel like I remember maybe it was even a few years after, which kind of shows how quickly the internet changed. But like, I would, again, watch my mom watch this movie and be like, oh, that looks so outdated already. Or like I was sitting there watching it tonight and they're emailing back and forth. And it kind of seems like they're emailing back and forth within minutes of each other. And I'm like thinking to myself, like, why aren't you chatting? Like, why aren't you messaging?
And but then it's weird.
He pulls it up and I was like, there we go. Okay. But like to think that that wasn't a really big thing is very strange, because I remember coming home from school and that was the first thing I did was, even though I just left these people, you would go hop on the computer and sit there and your friends would all sign on. And then you would just like instant message for the rest of the day.
And so that was
my first foray in the internet.
I've definitely had an email based pen pal pseudo. I don't say pseudo romantic because it wasn't, but it was charged. Relationship where we easily could have IM'd. And there's something about, and it's not like their emails were massively long, but there's something about like thinking about constructing something in the format of a letter versus just chatting back and forth. But it is different. And I actually get the appeal of that, and perhaps people should do it more. But I agree. Like, I definitely also really liked the element in this movie of both of them being kind of like, having that kind of I need to check my phone anxiety that we all have now, basically, but that people then didn't have. They didn't have like device anxiety, but Tom and Meg do have device anxiety because, oh my God, what's going on with everyone that I know in my phone? Like, as opposed, like for me, like the most of my social activities in my phone, especially like now, what's going on in the real world is just like time passing before I talk to people on my phone because I'm stuck in this house. So it was very interesting, like, yeah, watching them have device anxiety about like wanting to get back online, because I've had that since I was like 13 or 14. And I really liked seeing that. And again, just at the time, it was probably unusual. I don't know. It's interesting. Do you guys remember any other movies that used the internet kind of in the early years, Brittany or Ariana? Like, when did the internet, to your kind of memory of media, start becoming like normalized? Because no one in this movie has a mobile phone either. So when did that kind of thing start becoming a communication? Because it's a plot thing as well. It's like you can't message someone from your phone. Like, you can't, like, it puts space between communication if you needed to like call someone and tell them you weren't going to make it or like stuff like that. When do you guys remember it changing from being like the devices started changing plots of movies communication wise? Don't know if that sentence makes sense.
I was going to say Gossip Girl. That's what I remember.
That was what, 2005?
Yeah, that sounds right.
That sounds right. Yeah, it was the beginning of high school for me. So I think it was around 2005.
Seven, apparently. 2007.
Well, then not the beginning of high school.
Okay. No, I feel like it must have been before that. But, like, yeah, just where, like, I guess it was, like, you could you don't have the drama of someone thinking you've stood them up because you can call them on your fucking mobile phone. Like, I can't remember when that kind of thing changed. Not that he would have done that in this movie anyway because it was anonymous. But obviously having instant communication via phones is kind of an easy fix for a lot of classic rom-com twists and plots. So I'm trying to think when that really changed. I don't know. Anyway, this is definitely first of its kind and interesting because it was a circumstance where everyone else in their lives was like, this is weird, you're talking to someone on the internet. And obviously we've had so many, like, I chat to someone anonymously, who are they in real life? But these days, like, it's totally, the fact that you're going to meet them isn't a big deal. It's just like, oh, they might be anyone. There's a catfishing movie out, a Christmas catfishing movie out right now on Netflix with Harry Shum Jr. He's not the catfisher. He's like a side character. But there's a, you know, that kind of thing is already, is still a big plot point, I guess, like internet anonymous romance. But this was really the first of its kind.
Well, and for being one of the earlier movies that adopts this sort of technology,
yeah,
to automatically go straight to, like, the interpersonal relationship potential of the internet, rather than, like, look at all these other fun things I can do. Like the boyfriend, is that Greg Kinnear? Mentioned multiple times, especially in the beginning, like, oh, people are slacking off because they're playing solitaire or, you know, Fall of Western Civilization or whatever. But, like, instead of movies, I don't know, using the internet that way or in, like, even the hacker way, to see something so early go into what is the potential for this to bring for people deep together relation.
It's really interesting. I completely agree. I think that it is really beautiful for saying, because I think all of us, at least I have, and my dad, like, you know, I think he, like, goes back on it now, but when the internet started, we are of the generation that grew up pre-internet and got the internet within our adolescence. We are the main generation that normalized the internet after not having it. Generation before ours never quite normalized. I mean, they obviously used the internet, but, like, they didn't grow up with it. It was always a bigger stepping point for them. For us, it came right at the turning point where we remember before clearly, but we were the first people it was normalized for. And I think that what we would have heard from parents and stuff like that, and what she's hearing from Greg Kinnear, is like, what happens on the internet is fake. You're too distracted by the fake people in the computer to engage with the real life around you. And I've resented that sentiment my whole life because of what we mentioned, the skipping the small talk, that talking to people on the internet, it's often much more deep and complex conversations than you would have in real life, unless it was with a few people you were very close to. Because you're not just going to, like, be like, how's the weather where you are in a chat room? You're going to, like, start ranting about the stuff that you, like, genuinely have deep thoughts of. You go to big talk fast because there's just not, it's just weird to make small talk on the internet for no reason. Like, what would be the point of a conversation where you're just making small talk with a button, like with a cursor symbol? It doesn't make any sense. You'd get nothing out of logging on every day and being like, so how's the weather where you are?
That's what the chat robots were for.
Like, it's like the very foundation of talking to people on the internet is getting into the really deep conversations quickly. And so I've always resented that whole, like, it's not real, or the real engaging with the real world is more, like, deep. And I'm like, no, it's not. I don't engage with anyone that I meet in real life even a quarter as deeply as I've engaged with strangers I've talked to on the internet once. Like, it just, yeah. And so I think this movie is like kind of a point in the favor of that. It's showing like that power of being able to connect without artifice or without, you know, small talk.
And then also it shows both how far we've come and also not how far. Like, obviously we all met on the internet. At least I believe we all did. And like, for the most part, the people that I talk to in the real world here, or not the real world, in my physical life here in Illinois, like, they get it, but sometimes they don't understand what it's how like when I am talking to you guys. Yeah. And there was actually one of my favorite authors, Jacqueline Middleton, just put out a book recently. It's called The Certainty of Chance. And like, a big part of that is this girl is grieving the death of her friend going into this book, and her friend was an internet friend and they were best friends, but they had never met in person. And just like the different ways that people interact with her off of that. And it's so to see those same things reflected now as they were back then, like the technology has gone so far, but it's still not fully accepted.
Definitely the way of connect. There's definitely still a divide between like people who really get something out of being online and people who are sort of content in their own world offline. And yeah, it's just a very interesting one. That brings to the point, because you're having these deep connections with people, Meg asks early in the movie, is it cheating if you're just emailing each other? And that's a big question, because to me, yes, in terms of like, if you know to yourself your emotional engagement with emailing this guy is making you feel like a romantic way. And if, again, especially the fact they plan to meet, I would call that cheating. I don't think cheating is about physical act. I think it's about the mental, whether you are opening your mind, like being with someone is a choice. And if you are monogamous and then you are allowing your mind to open the door to other relationships in that way, like actually exploring the potential and indulging how they make you feel rather than closing the door and being like, I don't feel like engaging in this way, is like, if you know that the way that you're engaging is comparative to your monogamous relationship, that you are feeling about the messages in that way, then I think it's cheating. But I don't know, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I agree. And especially, like you said, that they were planning to meet up, you know, they go to have the planned meeting with the rose in the book. And
yeah, they're both still with their partners.
They're both still with their partners. But everything about the plan to meet up is done with a romantic undertone. Like, it's very clear that they both feel this way about each other. So I agree that it is, because it's something that they're both continuing to pursue with that angle in mind, with that level of awareness about it as well, that absolutely to me would fall under the umbrella of cheating.
Do you guys agree or disagree, Danielle or Ariana? Do you guys have thoughts on that?
Oh, I absolutely think it was kind of emotional cheating.
Yeah.
But I think it was emotional cheating, but hiding behind the fact that, like, oh, this technology is new, so it's the technology.
You don't know what this is.
Because, I mean, she sort of seemed to have one foot at least in the doorway the entire time. So it was just using the technology, I think, as a scapegoat, which, I mean, is an interesting scapegoat.
Brittany?
Yeah, if you're putting half of your energy into wanting to get back to something that's not the person sitting in front of you, but is in another room, like, you're only giving that person half of your attention and emotional effort. So I definitely would say it is. But again, they may not be thinking about that in this film because of the time period. It's like the Wild West of where I'm putting my emotional energy at this point, because, you know, I'm just throwing it out there into the ether. Like, I could be talking to...
Yeah, it's definitely not to say that you can't, like, spend heaps of time talking, like, you know, Cass is not cheating on her wife by spending hours talking to me on the internet, you know? Like, it's... You can definitely, like, put energy into people.
Yeah, but it's different. The context,
this,
I think,
this was, like, definitely... The fact that she had to ask, like, is it cheating... Like, the things that were being said were making her feel in a way that was not just a friend. I don't know.
And she was only doing it when she was home alone.
Yeah.
Like, she made sure that he was... Yeah, yeah.
Arianna?
Yeah, I was prepared to be, like, the dissenting opinion and be like, no, because internet relationships, you get so much deeper, like, so much faster. So they're really just, like, friends. But you've all convinced me, like, the rose in the book, no, that's romantic. Like, this is definitely cheating.
So. I do think that they could have just been friends. They didn't have to make it romantic, but apparently what they were feeling was, like, this is someone who I am attracted to the brain of, and that's, I know that's important. Frank and Patricia. So Greg Kinnear and Parker Posey, the girlfriend of Tom and the boyfriend of Meg. How did you guys feel about them? Like, I hate Greg Kinnear so much. Like, Greg Kinnear, nearly every single role he has ever played, maybe the exception of Little Miss Sunshine, I feel some pathos for him in that movie. He makes me want to murder him. I hate his face so much. Every role he plays is someone that I want to throw in the fucking river. I don't know why. He's probably a very nice man.
Natalie, what about that movie with Miley Cyrus where he's dying of cancer and she's singing songs on the piano?
I don't know what that movie is. What?
It's that Nicholas Sparks movie.
Yes, he's just a sad dad.
He
plays the piano and dies.
The last song, I haven't seen it. I mainly hate him from As Good As It Gets. He makes me want to commit actual murder in As Good As It Gets. I don't know why, but the reason I'm bringing this up is because in the first half of this movie, I felt this way. In the second half of this movie, I'm like, okay, I'm actually, like, not that mad at him. I think the breakup between him and Meg is amazing. I think it's...
I love it so much.
It's the healthiest breakup in anything
else. It's so good. And I'm just like, holy... He really was pissing me off. Like, he's an egocentric wanker and all... Like, he was really annoying. But in the second half of the movie, I liked it. And the breakup was just great. Like, it was just... It was so good. But I also bring up how much I hate his face because... Brittany and I saw him. We were at a small gig.
I've had the immense pleasure of watching Natalie just, like, see a celebrity and be like, we need to leave.
So he was at the same showing of In and of Itself that we were at, which is the small magic illusion storytelling spoken word performance that everyone should watch. It's coming to Disney Plus. A documentary about it that kind of shows how the show worked is coming to Disney Plus this holiday season. It was on Hulu. The live show was just unbelievable. So many people saw it and it was very lauded. So yeah, I think he had a lot of various celebrities attend as audience members. It's New York. A tiny theater, and Greg Kinnear was at ours. And I was like, oh my God. Yeah. I was just like, I'm sure he's very nice, but
I didn't know this hatred existed inside Natalie. And so I was just like, oh my God, is that Greg Kinnear? And she's like, yeah, it is. And I'm like, okay.
And the funny thing about that is it was coming off the back of a day where this had already happened to me once. And that was the problem. This had already happened. Like, I saw in in the middle of the city in Broadway, in the Broadway box, like off, it was near the Cursed Child Theater, I think. I saw another actor who also makes me feel this way, whose name is Tom Hollander. Do you guys know? Not Tom Holland, the Spider-Man, Tom Hollander, the British accent, a British actor. He was in Pirates of the Caribbean. He is also in this, one of my favorite shows ever, which is a mini series called Desperate Romantics about the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. And he plays John Ruskin, who is just this completely disgusting pedophile, gross guy.
Oh, and yes, he has a very punchable face. I and just looked
in Pirates of the Caribbean, he plays a really, really frustrating,
The British
nasty
guy.
He plays Beckett, not Norrington, not Jason Isaacs as Norrington, who I love. Not Jack Davenport as Norrington, who I adore. He's like antagonist of the first film. Cutler Beckett, who is like the head of the East India Trading Company. He's disgusting and gross. Tom Hollander also played Mr. Collins in the 2005 Pride and Prejudice, if you guys saw
very
that.
Punchable. Yes. Very, very punchable.
Very punchable.
So he has done a couple of
casting
roles.
Casting is
like.
A plus there.
He has done a couple of roles I like, but Desperate Romantics and Pirates of the Caribbean, like, I hate him so much in those films. So pre-Greg Kinnear, same day, I'd already seen Tom Hollander in the Broadway box. And I was like, oh. So I think Greg Kinnear got like a bit of my Tom Hollander hate as well when we saw him. But the point is, I was really prepared to hate him all through this movie. And then halfway through, I'm like, okay, Greg Kinnear, okay, all right. And that breakup scene, what was good about it? Like, what did you guys like about it?
It was just so healthy. Whenever I watch this movie, I always kind of forget how good terms they end things. Like they really, it's just a very comfortable, and it gives me the impression that they're actually going to stay friends, and it kind of makes me hope that they do.
Yeah,
instantly
changed. As soon as they were like starting to break up, it instantly changed to like laughing and teasing about like their future. And I'm like, oh my God. Like,
yeah, like I want them to be best friends now. Like, it's just very comfortable. It's almost like they somehow managed to show that transition into a friendship from a relationship, like from a romantic relationship, within about 30 seconds.
It
just feels natural and
that's
real.
The thing. And yeah, because he wasn't like a bad person, and it was like, I don't know, does anyone else have any thoughts about Frank, I guess? Because I feel like this is, you're always waiting in a rom-com for the, if you start the movie with partners, you're always waiting for the partner to get like villainized. And it's kind of like, even in this movie, you think he's about to say that he cheated on her, but he didn't, you know, like.
Well, even in the earlier moment when they're watching the video, playback of the episode of the TV show that he had an interview on, even the way they act with each other there, I think that's probably sort of planting the seed of them being better as friends, maybe, because of the way that they both react to him, obviously sort of getting flustered with this other woman.
Yeah. I don't know. It's really unusual. Yeah. I can't think of a comparable one. Do you guys have any comparable kind of breakups? What do you guys think of like a rom-com where either one or both people have partners at the start? Do you feel like that's like stressful, or do you feel like there's a specific way that needs to be handled?
I mean, it depends on how they frame it. If they frame it as like, this guy is a really good person, like there's nothing wrong. There's never anything wrong with the white men in these movies, but like, if there's nothing wrong with him, then you feel really, I feel a sense of guilt throughout the movie, which perhaps
decide.
Yeah. Which like, or like, you know, he's going to get hurt.
I generally feel that for the women, for the girlfriends of the, they nearly always make the woman, the girlfriend of the lead, like evil in some way. So
yeah. Or like annoying. Helpless in a way.
Yeah.
And so like, and then there's the other side where like they're a not great person. And so that's kind of the way that it was framing for this, to the point where like he was such an insufferable know-it-all that I would brace myself, not remembering how the breakup went, like brace myself for one of those like uncomfortable egomaniacal breakups.
Yeah. I kind of like that they turn it around. Ariana, you kind of mentioned this the other week when we talked about What If and Zoe Kazan breaking up with Rafe Spall, like the like that relationship when before she got together with Dan Rad. How do you feel about like the original boyfriends or the original girlfriends in rom-coms generally?
Oh, generally, I definitely don't have similar feelings to you guys. I don't feel bad for them because they're just serving a purpose to this larger narrative of soulmates that we've come to watch. What I like about them, about the boyfriends and girlfriends in this movie, is that they're entertaining, and which is what I usually hope for.
Yeah.
And usually I feel like rom-coms are pretty good about like giving them a nice ending in some way, like knowing that
unless they're like a gross person.
Like they'll be fine. They're gonna go find their own person and be the leads in their own movie.
Life. One of my favorite rom-com boyfriends who gets dumped is Matthew Good in Imagine Me and You, the lesbian rom-com. Have you guys seen that movie?
Yeah, I was actually going to mention that
He's great. And they make sure to give him, like, the start of, like, clearly an awesome new girl at the end of that movie. So I really love that one. There are definitely some where I'm like, should have stayed with the original person. But I loved her, Parker Posey, Patricia, in this movie. I thought she was really funny and really cool, and you know, she was a bit shouty and a bit stressed, but like she wasn't mean.
She's screaming at people in an elevator.
That you have to forgive that, because that was like claustrophobia stress, like that was like panic. I feel like that's totally forgivable. That wasn't like, it wasn't like her behavior in the elevator was what made him dump her. It was more like, I found that very forgivable. She's just a hard-hitting New Yorker.
Very high-strung woman. I think the fact that she was introduced with Patricia makes coffee nervous.
I loved her. I thought she was great, and I don't find that mean at all. Like, that's just a New Yorker. I found that completely normal. And, she wasn't soft, but that doesn't have to be everything. But yeah, Brittany, do you have any thoughts about the boyfriend and the girlfriend at the start of the movie or anything like that?
I like when they're there, and like in this movie, they come to a point where they're just like, this has run its course, and why, like, neither of us want to keep trying, but let's just like go our separate ways. I don't really care what happens to them after that point. Like, I don't need them to be involved in the movie anymore. They can go off into the sunset. But I think that this movie did a good job of like pivoting to keep them a little bit involved in this latter half of the movie. But
yeah,
so I'm kind of like in the middle ground. I want them to go off nicely. I don't always need someone to be villainized.
I'm glad that they weren't.
I think that can go really wrong really fast. And also it doesn't allow the person who is being either broken up with or doing the breaking up time to move on, because it's like, that's something like that could be easily like traumatic, and you should probably take a month or two to like chill out before you dive into a new relationship. Whereas if it's amicable and it's sort of just like
run its course,
you're parting, you obviously have been weaning yourself out of it for a while at that point, even subconsciously. And so it's not going to hit as hard. Whereas I feel like if it's like, oh, you were cheating, and then it's like you have all this like pent up energy and like anger, and then you're just like, never mind, I found the love of my life. Okay, bye.
Yeah.
Like, I agree. I feel that it's always like a little rushed in that sense. But I think this is good.
I absolutely really did like them, how they did it in this movie. Like I said, Matthew Good in Imagine Me and You is definitely someone. It's not like I think she should have stayed with him, but that was one that I always sticks out as really gorgeous and like empathetic, like towards him, and really nicely done. And I can't think of any others right now, but this was an interesting one. But going into our actual leads, the actual point of this movie, the plot, the tropes, the chemistry between Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks as Kathleen and Joe. This is a movie that's full of romance tropes. It's got enemies to lovers and it's got friends to lovers. It's got a two-person love triangle. What are some other classic, like what would you tag this on AO3 with, Cass, if you were writing this as a fic or an AU?
I mean, I would pretty much use those three. Maybe also idiots to lovers a little bit.
Arianna, what do you like best about tropes and what do you think makes a trope work rather than, because people, there's a lot of like, oh, if something uses a trope, then it's bad. No, you're confusing the word trope with cliche. So what makes a trope sing to like well executed, basically?
Oh, I don't know. What that's what makes them so hard.
Yeah.
But I do feel like this is such a great, I do think it's like, in my opinion, the perfect enemies to lovers. And I think part of what makes it so good is that they also have their friends to lovers
and they have
going on the side.
They have,
because it's a love triangle.
You've got enemies to lovers. You've got enemies to lovers for Joe and Meg. And then you've got friends to lovers for Shop Girl and NY152. But Joe and Meg are actually enemies to friends to lovers. Like it's because it's really good that they form a friendship as themselves before mm-hmm. they get together. Like, so there's that element as well.
I think trying to make it healthy, I think, is the hardest thing to do.
Yeah. And I think that it's okay when like rom-coms and like stuff like that isn't healthy and it's just totally indulgent, unrealistic nonsense. But I think what sets aside a movie as like being really fucking good is when it actually does take care of the characters.
Yes, I agree. Because, like, for example, The Proposal is super unhealthy, but it's such a great rom-com. It's wonderful.
Is that the Sandra Bullock one? Yeah. I haven't seen it, but I really want to.
So I don't know what it is. I feel like it takes a special bit of magic. I don't know. Someone else, Brittany, you watch a lot of rom-coms.
Yeah. What do you like about tropes? Or do you like them to be twisted a bit?
So, all right. Maybe also like not even so much like rom-coms lately, but I've been reading a lot of romance novels this year. Yeah. And there's like,
you can just read,
yeah, you can just like read the description and know exactly what beats you're going to get. And I think a really well done, like enemies to lovers is like, oh, let's say like, someone like we were like high school rivals but now like 15 years have passed and there's just like a lot of stuff that's unsaid that needs to be unpacked very slowly. So I like when people go into something, and it works in this movie too, where it's like, she only knows like Joe Fox, the name, and he only sees the little shop, like this little small business owner. But then he gets these little nuggets, like he sees the picture of her with her mom and that here's the twirling story, and she starts to see his like messed up family tree, and then like there's all these little things that they sort of start to put together that unpack, like shatter that initial image. So I think in enemies to lovers, when done well, really sets up this heightened image at the beginning and slowly chips away at it, and then but you have to do it right. You can't just be like, oh, here's one major sad story that's going to change my perception of you immediately. It's like, no, there has to be more.
It has to be a slow burn. I think for me, enemies to lovers, what it really clinches on for me, and I've been thinking about this a lot because my current favorite like fan fiction ship is an enemies to lovers ship. And I it's not one I often go for. I'm not usually like a rivals. I'm not usually like chemistry and rivals. Like that's actually historically, that's not actually been what I've gone for in a lot of romances. Though of course I've seen lots that I liked. But I've been thinking about it tons lately, and I think for me it's like it comes to like the opposite of hate. You know, the opposite of love isn't hate; it's indifference, and it's kind of like if someone gets under your skin, if you're kind of enemies with someone, you're very hyper focused on them. And this is great for Ben and Devi as well in Never Have I Ever. It's completely what they have going on, which we've talked about on the weather like several times. When you are hyper fixated on someone as a rival and you spend a lot of time thinking about them and they get under your skin, when someone is in your skin already and then you no longer have the conflict issue, then what? Then you're stuck with this person under your skin and you start like noticing maybe good things about them as opposed to bad, you know, like it's kind of like, you know, just like, oh, this person's gone away. It's like you're already obsessed with this person. So you're already hyperfixating on them. So when you're hyperfixating on them and the big conflict goes away or like becomes more nuanced, then you're going to hyperfixate on them still and you're going to notice like all of these things about them that you now like. So that's where really enemies to lovers really gets to me, like when it's like still that level of passion that they felt about the person in a negative way, but it's like the negativity is stripped out of the passion and then it's like confused passion and then it's good passion. So that's why I like it, I think. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the entire time you were saying that, I just kept on picturing the music video for the song Genghis Khan. I don't know if anybody else knows.
What has that got to do with it?
I know the song. I don't know the video though.
I feel like you're going to all just need to watch this video at some point. It's basically it's like a James Bond supervillain and a James Bond.
You're talking about the Mike Snow, like Mika Snow song.
That's the one. If you haven't seen the music video for that, that is an enemies to lovers, a gay enemies to lovers music video.
Based on James Bond and a Bond villain.
Yeah, pretty much. But I started thinking about it when you first started talking about, you know, having that kind of level of fixation and like a negative passion turning into a positive passion. It's all I could picture the whole time you were talking.
But, yeah, I mean, obviously, yeah, I mean, like with rivals version. To lovers, like, yeah, you know, whether it's, yeah, rival, I think, yeah, like we've said, like Ben and Davey on Never Have I Ever is like a current one, and we'll get into that in a second because Tom Hanks is a grown-up, sad little rich boy. Danielle, do you like tropes? Do you like the feeling of like a predictable trope and knowing how something's going to go, or do you like it to be twisted in some way?
Oh no, I like the tropes. Uh-huh. I don't mind a surprising twist every once in a while, but there are tropes that I do not like. The biggest one being accidental or whatever, pregnancy, secret child shows up. I don't like children and I don't like old people. So like when they pop up.
I love old people. I hate children.
I'm just a terrible person. When they pop up, like that's not a surprise I enjoy. But like I like knowing the beats of being able to track where they are on the progression towards each other. Mm-hmm. Because I love seeing it happen, but there is comfort in knowing that like
it's this, a safety
this
thing.
Is what's going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like, you're not just in reading a book and like not knowing how you're going to feel at the end of it. And I think that like is a comfort thing and like sometimes it's great to watch a book or read a book or watch a movie and kind of not, and like just experience it and feel confusing things, but like sometimes even if you don't know the plot, you need to know that you're going to come out of it like feeling satisfied, like I expect this is going to happen and then the thing happens and I feel satisfied for having known it was going to happen and watched it happen, you know, like
yeah. And it's like a journey. The journey is the most important part. Just because it's sketched out, I know some of the beats that are going to happen. I don't know how they're going to get to where they need to get to. And I think that is where the true enjoyment comes. And that's obviously where like the character really shines through, is in those in-betweens.
Yeah. So I think for me with this movie, we're going to talk about Meg and Tom, and Meg is great in this movie, but I feel like it's like Tom is the real reason
it works.
He's the real star. He's the real reason it works.
I don't want to gloss over Meg because
I
think
I don't either. But it's kind of like I we'll talk about it because I don't know. Let's talk about Tom first, and then I want to talk about Meg, because the thing for me that I find Tom's track completely believable the whole way. And I think Meg is amazing, but because we are following Tom knowing that the shop girl is Kathleen and Meg doesn't, and we only see her at the end being like, I hoped it was you. I really would have liked to get more point of view from her on that, because like it could have been really traumatic for her. Like it ended happily, but we didn't really follow her thinking that it might be him or want or fear. We didn't really follow her conflict to me about like, I might love Joe, but I think I love the computer man. Like we stick more with Joe in terms of how he feels about Kathleen / shop girl. It's difficult, but yeah. Why don't you say what you want to say about Meg first, and then we'll kind of swing back around to like how their characters like get to track.
First of all, I think that, not to disagree, because I do think you have a really valid point, but I think what's so special about Meg, like why she is such a rom-com queen and like why Nora casts her in like all of her movies, is she has like this it quality that is so hard to pinpoint. Like she's this beautiful woman who looks like a movie star, but she's still so relatable. Like there's just something about her that's effortlessly relatable, and she feels like an underdog. And I feel like I'm making a huge generalization, but I feel like a lot of women go in watching rom-coms because it is this kind of like aspirational story.
Self-identifying.
And, yes. Yeah. And to yeah. be aspirational, you have to be able to identify
with the lead.
And so she has to be an underdog in some way, because you feel like an underdog in your own life. And I also feel like, I mean, I know a lot of people like love Notting Hill, but I feel like this is the big difference between like Julia Roberts and Pretty Woman versus like Julia Roberts and Notting Hill.
Oh, interesting. Because Notting Hill is my favorite rom-com, and I don't, and it's because of what you just said. I do not go into rom-coms in any kind of identifying way. I love watching stories about famous people, or like that Notting Hill is my number one rom-com of all time. And it's because of that fame. It's because of that alien element. So okay. It's interesting. But I do totally agree with why it is important for a rom-com like this. But
Notting Hill is interesting to me. I don't like Notting Hill, but Notting Hill is interesting to me because I feel like it's a movie that immediately I could tell, like, oh, this is written by a man, because the man is the aspirational underdog.
I agree.
But anyway, so she does that really well. And I feel like, for example, She's All That, Danielle, I really love it. I feel like Rachel Lee Cook is so good at that in every movie she does. The Hallmark movie she did, like, that's why I'm watching her in Hallmark movies, because she still has that. She doesn't always get a great lead, but she has that quality.
There's a certain sweetness, like, I think, both to her and Meg Ryan.
But
they can stick up for each other, for themselves when pressed.
Like another great one, I feel like, is Lana Condor in To All the Boys I've Loved Before. Mm-hmm. I feel like she really has that quality. I feel like that quality is what makes her so good in rom-coms. And because she is such a she's almost like a self-insert kind of person, I feel like she is very good at showing you like the way the audience feels about Tom Hanks in this movie. You know that she feels the same way. Like when he comes in with the daisies and you see like, oh, he's like, you see her kind of like falling in love with him in that
and
moment.
And she kind of gets angry that he's done it like a little bit. Like, and
And then like later on, as they're like at the farmer's market, you see her like excited to bump into him. And so I feel like she becomes the audience character. Like you understand how she feels because you're watching him do these nice things, and you're like, she has to feel like how I feel, if that makes sense. But his is definitely, as you were saying, more spelled out for us.
Yeah, so it's interesting because he is basically Tom as Joe finds out somewhat early on that Meg is shop girl. So he is continuing their relationship both in a contentious way when they are fighting and then later befriending her, completely knowing the whole time that he's the person she's writing to. And this could be very dodgy. It is still slightly dodgy. It's interesting because he, when I understand, it's kind of like you understand straight away why he doesn't tell her immediately, because it's at a point where they are really at odds with each other. And it would be like losing something really good. Was it a bad decision not to tell her? Maybe. Yeah, probably. Probably it was very bad. But you kind of get that he was like, if I tell her, it's going to like ruin everything. Not necessarily like he thinks that he, I don't think he was thinking about whether it was sustainable or not, but it's kind of like, you know, she is not currently at the point where like she would forgive this, like where I would, where me doing this would, me revealing this to her would make her change her mind about me as a person. And, you know, when she's interacting with him, it's not like Joe has a crush on Kathleen until he knows it's her, because he finds her very contentious and she you know, is quite conflicty with him. And I kind of get that it's like you've kind of sunk, you get to the point where you like sink into this hole. It's like the time for instant truth passes. And then due to the conflict that you're in at that point, and then you're stuck in the lie, and it gets to the point where it becomes weird to tell someone how long you've known the secret, and it becomes an issue that you've been sitting on it. Like the fact that you've kept it a secret becomes an issue, and it's kind of like, how the fuck do you get out of that cycle? So do you guys have like empathy for him for not telling her, or do you think it was wrong?
I think it's I think that the Tom Hankosity of it is that sort of his saving grace. I do feel like if it wasn't Tom Hanks, I would find it creepier, which
yeah,
there's probably something to unpack there. But the, because yeah, like on the surface level, just looking at specifically what he knew and when he knew it and how he chose to keep it to himself and everything, that, how yeah. he used it, and was a little bit manipulative with, you know, telling her like different, like once he sort of found out from her that she had this internet friend and sort of pretended to learn about it and that sort of thing, give advice.
Once they become friends and he's like, oh, do you think he's married, or like suggesting yeah. all these things, that feels a bit
manipulative.
If I was him, it's not even manipulative. It's just weird.
It's weird.
Like if it was me, I would like be trying to avoid the topic. I would be like, I'd be privately be like, I have to find a way to tell her the truth. And until then, I'm not like, he's like, he plays it up. And I'm just like, I don't know how that makes me feel. Ariana, Brittany, Danielle, how does that make you feel? Especially that portion where they're friends and he's playing up, helping her with the internet relationship.
I mean, like Cass mentioned, I think it truly only works because it's Tom Hanks, because Tom Hanks has this.
We know he's good. We're meant to empathize with him. We know he's a good guy.
He has this like inherent goodness to him. He's our, you know, our good guy of our time. So we know like Tom Hanks can do no wrong. So that's why it works. But I do also feel like the thing that I really noticed on this rewatch that I feel like also makes it work is that scene when she sends the email and he's going to email her back and be like, I'm sorry, I couldn't make it. I got into a car crash, or I had a meeting or something. And he purposefully, he like deletes what he wrote. And he said, I'm so sorry you didn't get what you expected. You deserve more. Like he purposefully was like, I'm not going to lie, which I guess I know it's like,
he does kind of lie. I mean, he lies like for the rest of the movie, but he also like is purposefully not lying. Like for the rest of the movie, he doesn't lie to her.
He's trying to reconcile. Yeah. And that's the thing. It's really interesting because and he's also not really, he doesn't ride her back straight away because he's really horrified by how she treats him in the cafe. Like, kind of is a minute for he's reconciling, like, oh, who she is online isn't who she is as a person. Like, she's horrible. And yes, he was putting her out of business, which is bad. She was making a lot of judgments of him as a person and about his relationship with reading and all of that kind of stuff that was like, she was making personal judgments about him based on the stuff that his business did that I understand, but still were not particularly fair. And he's about to drop the relationship completely online because he's like, wow, shop girl is not nice in person. We're not going to get along. Like, not even because we're at conflict, but because of how she treated him. And then she sends NY152 the email being like, I can't believe I did this to this man. Like, it's so wrong. So he gets sort of an apology from her. Joe gets an apology via the way of the email. And that makes him still like her, basically, I guess. And it's very complicated. And obviously she then goes on to apologize in person for, like, the way that he brings out this kind of reactionary behavior in her. I kind of really love the way where he shuts her up. In any other movie, I would be like, don't fucking shut her up and cover her mouth. But in this, it's, like, very hot. And when she's about to snap and because he knows that she's going to regret it. It's very complicated, but when it gets to the point where he's befriending her as himself and kind of, yeah, playing around with the internet thing, Brittany, Danielle, do you guys have any thoughts about, I guess, the ethics of that or, like, whether it works or, like, it's difficult?
I also have one more thing.
Oh, yeah, please.
Because I also feel like I get that it's weird, but I also sort of feel like he was hanging a lantern on it. Like, he was, by bringing it up so much,
he was trying to make her think about it.
Yes. And I think he did, because remember when she was like, I was hoping it was you, because that's like all they talk about.
That's the thing. I want to discuss that because I do, because it's interesting. I think it's really interesting that he offers up his feelings to her as Joe before the meeting up on the same day. Like, hey, choose. But it's kind of weird to be like, choose me or choose him. It's kind of like, do you think that he was purposely leading her to it? That's what is that what you think that was happening? He was purposely
I think he was trying to like get her to associate them together. Like those two personas together.
Yeah.
Just, it feels so weird. Like, it feels, again, it's Tom Hanks, so it doesn't feel as bad as it maybe should, but it feels so manipulative, actually, to the point where from the moment where they start becoming friends again, actually, no, from the moment that she like loses the shop, it felt like the normal rom-com formula would have had a sort of montage after that point. Of like what her life is like afterwards, maybe they're still sending emails back and forth, and then get to them meeting in person. Like, it felt, for some reason, the movie, I was not expecting it to spend as long as it did on then their friendship after this big thing happened. And then building up a friendship. It felt like a different movie to me.
I think that it's important that it happened in terms of you don't want it to go from just, it's Joe Fox from Fox Book. He closed my store and I hate him, to her instantly having to reconcile, like, I love the man on the internet and it's my enemy.
No, of course.
Like, I think the important, that building Joe and Kathleen as friends was important, but it's still,
but they did it in such a condensed amount of time.
It was a bit odd. I kind of liked a lot of those elements that kind of happen after. It's kind of like she made peace with the fact that, like, this happened. Like, it's bad luck, and it's not like Joe wanted the store to close. Like, it's not like, it didn't really seem like they were trying to like buy. Yes, he mentioned this store going out of business, the other store going out of business and buying up their collection. But it's kind of not like he wanted, he was, you know, putting his business first, and it's not like he wanted the store to close. Like, if they could have kept their amount of business the same without Fox Books taking away from it, it's not like he was trying to buy them out. Like, it was kind of just, and she goes to Starbucks, and like Leo points, and she's like, Leo was like, she's perfectly happy drinking at Starbucks as opposed to an independent coffee shop. But it's tough. And the bit when they're friends and he's helping her with the computer guy and the amount that they talk about it, I don't know. Brittany, what do you think of that? That kind of like level of deception? I don't know if that's the right word.
I want to say it's creepy, but the whole plot hinges on it. So
yeah, it's like, difficult.
If he doesn't do it, then they're both in the dark, and I don't know if it would have worked.
If I agree, they were, go ahead. I was just going to say, like, Brittany, like, the movie doesn't happen if he tells her in the coffee shop that he's the internet.
What if he never found out that scene didn't happen? So if they stayed pen pals, but Joe and Kathleen became friends, but Joe didn't know that the pen pal was Kathleen.
Yeah. So, like, let's say, like he got held up at work or something and missed the date completely, like never walked by the shop or something.
And the plot, so he and her would still connect as Joe and Kathleen, but the reveal was a surprise to both of them.
Yeah. Which is a very different movie.
It is completely different. And it's still kind of like, that would mean both of them were, I think that would also have, you'd have both characters torn between their lover, their internet lover and their real life friend that they might have a crush on. Whereas for him, he knows it's all her. It's difficult. I'm sure that it would be received more creepily today than it was in 1998. Like in 1998, they were probably like, yeah, it's the internet, weird shit happens. But it's just interesting. I do have empathy for the concept that you get caught in a lie or you get caught in missing information and it just gets awkward to reveal it. Like the time has passed where revealing it would be normal and you panicked and then you don't reveal it, and the fact that you haven't revealed it becomes this whole like thing, and it becomes like morally dodgy that you haven't revealed it. I've seen that happen in quite innocent ways. This is slightly less innocent than that, but it's tough, and the movie does hinge on it. But do you think there's any modern current actor, like age 20s or 30s actor right now working who could do this if the movie was made now that you would be okay with?
Chris Evans.
Yeah, that would be nice.
I feel like he would be able to pull
you
it off.
You know that he's like a good guy.
Put him in a sweater. He'll get everyone on board.
Look, he was very evil in a sweater in Knives Out, so I don't know what you want.
I think he might be too handsome.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I've completely forgotten every male actor.
Every actor that's in movies. Yes. John Cho.
Oh, actually, what's his name?
I believe John Cho could do it.
Pardon?
Chidi, I can't think of his name.
William Jackson Harper?
Yeah. I could see William Jackson Harper.
I could see him doing it too.
He has a very trustworthy face.
Daniel Radcliffe.
Daniel Radcliffe.
You could do it. So, I would say Simu Liu, too. I feel like I would believe him because he has, like, a charming face.
He's too innocent. I think there has to be a bit of cheekiness.
Bit of an edge. Fine.
Yeah, actually, and now that I'm thinking about it, William Jackson Harper is, again, the too handsome. He's too handsome.
I'm trying to think. All of the actors that, like, in my mind, like, the prime romantic leads are all, like, actually older now than I think they are in my head, like James McAvoy.
James McAvoy might be able to, because he's played some Yeah, it's hard because he's like rich, so you have to believe that he had some hardship in life.
Well, let's talk about the sad little rich boy element then. Ariana, why don't you take that away? Because, oh, yeah.
I don't know what to say about this other than...
I mean, we're looking at, you know, Kathleen. The thing is that's interesting is Fox and Shop Around the Corner are both like family businesses. They are both family businesses, yet there's such a big divide between the two elements. Which is completely different, I think, than if he'd just been like a corporate, like this was just his job that he'd done as a corporate thing. Maybe their business was as small as Shop Around the Corner when they started it, and they chose to try and grow, whereas Shop Around the Corner was never like an expansion kind of shop. And
I mean,
I don't know.
I guess, but you are. I mean, this is a very like capitalist movie, which are just some things I have to accept to get through it. But like, I mean, you don't get that rich without like fucking over a lot of people,
yeah.
Which I'm sure his grandfather and father did.
Yeah.
I mean, but, and even Joe was quite gleefully like, you know, talking about how the other little store had gone out of business, and
yeah,
when he first walks and into his dad's office, off
the stock and stuff.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's interesting. They definitely don't go into too much of like the wealth stuff. And again, like Notting Hill, when people are in some way wealthy or famous, I like the story to be about that. I like the story to deal with like how that makes their perception of things weird, if you know what I mean, because being rich makes people very weird. And I like stories about people being weird because they're rich. So I would have liked a bit more like that. Like, I didn't want to see them like, you know, happily being in a relationship for another half an hour in the movie, but I would be very curious to see about like what happened between them financially after they got together, or like their lifestyle change from like Meg's little apartment, which still would have been very expensive to live on the Upper West Side, an apartment like that, to like Tom's more lavish lifestyle and all of that kind of stuff. And I really would have liked to see all of that.
I think what makes Joe Fox like as a character interesting and his family interesting, which this is like leading a little bit into the next point, but
yeah.
We can just go in there, is that like his family, like it's very obvious that he had like his childhood was not easy, that it was it was rife with like family drama, but broken, it's also
families and distant parenting,
yeah, but it's also very obvious that like his dad and I guess his grandpa to some extent, like his dad tried his best.
Yeah,
and they like seem very maybe his warm. Best wasn't good enough, but like he clearly like loves his children.
Mm. They had the warm family, you know, like Joe and the children that he's related to, and yeah, they, you know, seem to like hanging out as a family and stuff. It's just interesting. Would have been interesting to get a bit more of the backstory of Celia and the granddad, but it is an interesting movie. Family legacy wise, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of Celia and the granddad, like her, it is very much a movie about legacy, even though that's like definitely a theme that's a little bit lower tier theme. But like Celia, everyone kind of talks about her like she's a saint and like she's this perfect person, and she's dead, so that's like easier to do. But like Kathleen is really trying to like live up to her mom, or like keep her mom's legacy alive in some way, because that's what she feels like she owes her mom, is to try and be like as good as she was, or to bring the same kinds of things that her mom was able to bring to other people. And Joe is like also kind of living through his family's legacy of this like superstore, And also, like, his grandpa, like, his dad repeating, like, his grandpa's mistakes and not being able to, like, keep their family together, even though they, like, clearly very much love their kids. They're very imperfect parents. So it's, like, that juxtaposition is really interesting.
Yeah. The one element about money in this film that I really liked was the Thanksgiving scene in Zabar's, where it could have easily been like him forcing Kathleen to let him pay for her stuff, but instead, like, and you know, he probably would have, but he judged it in like a second and a half to be like, okay, what needs to happen here is that this woman needs to let her pay. Like, it didn't, like, it was kind of, he was willing to use his charms and his wiles to get Kathleen to be allowed to swipe her credit card, and it would have been totally different if it, like, so it was like very slight white knighting. It was kind of wily fox white knighting, but if he'd white knighted in terms of like slapping money down, that would have been completely different for me. And I really loved that little, like, that kind of little element. But yeah, when money is a factor in a relationship, I generally want to know more about how money is a factor. So it would have been interesting to see more about that. But I think that the fact that this movie, like, the shop closes, like, Kathleen, she decides to go out of business. She does, you know, that within a few months of Fox opening, like, you know, would you, you know, I don't know how quickly businesses give up. Like, she gives up on business only about 4 months or something, or 3 months after Fox opens, like, as opposed to like trying to give it a year or whatever, which means they must be pretty tightly strung in terms of finances in the shop, and that month to month it was not going to cover itself with the amount of loss that they were having, which is really sad. You know, it's sad, but it would have been, again, a very different movie if it had been like, the shop is saved. Though I don't know why the rich shop assistant didn't just like put her money into it, because that was kind of like confusing and weird. But the fact that the shop got closed and Kathleen got to move on, or had to move on, was kind of, I guess, what sets this aside from, like, because aren't all Hallmark Christmas movies and stuff about like going back to like save the small business from going under? Is that not like a classic trope in romance movies?
I mean, like 95% of the time, yeah.
Sometimes it's a haunted inn with a hot ghost. I mean, but it's pretty similar.
Do they ever fail?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But there's sometimes a lesson to be learned.
Sometimes they fail. I found it interesting in this one, yeah, like that it fails, like that she does make the decision. And it also kind of had me questioning, like, did she inherited the shop from her mother and she obviously really loved it. But does inheriting a family business, like, trap you from finding your own path?
I think there's an element of that.
I think
early in the movie she's talking to Frank about it, sort of like, what do I do? Like, what do I really do? And then, you know, at the very end when she's talking to Joe about how she's writing the children's book, so that she's still got that connection to her mother, but in her own way. So I do feel like that possibly could have been developed a little bit more. That's probably like the one thing in this movie that I do wish there was a bit more.
I guess my question is, like, you could take a totally different twist on things and say that she never wanted to, it's not that she never wanted to run the bookshop, but it was kind of like she was conditioned into running the bookshop and didn't have a chance to like discover her own path. And so, yeah, I don't know. What do you guys feel about that? Like, it doesn't make sense.
I feel like I had never noticed it until this rewatch, because obviously we're rewatching it with a lot more, like, looking for things, I guess, with a more investigative eye. Yeah, it's a critical eye. But I really feel like it's one of the more beautiful things about this movie is that, like, she wanted to, like, she loved her mother so much and she wanted to continue her mother's legacy. And because of that, she just like she had accepted this. And I do think that she loved running the bookstore and
that
was a passion of hers. But when that got taken away, she was able to discover a passion that was her own. And she kind of, she ends up realizing that the bookstore isn't her mother's legacy. She's her mother's legacy. And she's able to put back like the same warmth and care and love that her mom did into the world in a different way. And I just thought that was so beautiful. And maybe he's the hero for making her shut down the shop.
Well, I loved that it was Fox was not as bad as, you know, it's still a bookstore, you know, it was not as evil as it was made out to be. And, you know, the fact that we saw like that there were things that Joe had done that were quite personal, like curating special collections and displays. And, you know, obviously the thing with the interview got cut. And basically you see that there is a level of passion involved and that it's meant, you know, he's trying to make it a big social space where people can hang out and read. And I mean, I like the big Barnes and Noble in Union Square and stuff like that, like in New York. Like this shop in real life is based on slightly on Books of Wonder, which is right around the corner from the big Barnes and Noble in Union Square. And both of them are still functioning, or maybe the pandemic changed that. But and I like both of those bookshops equally for different reasons. Sometimes I want to go around in a bookshop and sit down in the corner and be left alone, like, you know. And I like the way that they kind of fed in that, you know, he gave her employee, like Steve Zahn, George, who was like a quiet hero of this movie, who was freaking hilarious. He works there now and he curates the children's book section with the degree of passion that little shop, you know, shop around the corner did and stuff. Like, I like that Fox wasn't like as evil and villainous as, you know, as they kind of had this perception it was when they were closing the shop. And just that, you know, it's life, it's business, and it's tough and but not bad. Is that what you meant by that it was like a sad but hopeful ending, Ariana, in the doc? In terms of her legacy? Like
that's what I meant by it.
Yeah. Anyone else got any thoughts about that? I guess about how they kind of handled that whole, like the shop closing, like, do you feel like it's the right choice?
I definitely think it's the right choice. I think it's a little bit of a surprising choice just with it. Movies like this would make me think like, oh, they're going to save it. But I think it's the right choice. If anything, I would have wanted more of her personal journey after it closed. I think just a little bit more meat there for me would have been perfect. But I think that they made the right choice in, and then also like have her moving forward and growing as a person by herself rather than just with Joe.
I mean, I loved Patricia being like, I want to hire her. She'd be a good editor and she should, you know, she's amazing at curating children's books. So definitely we want her to come and judge whether something would be, you know, popular or not. And obviously that's not the job she takes, but that's like a totally valid thing. And it's just, it's interesting. In general, I would have liked to see more of her in the back half of the movie in general. Because like you said, you miss quite a bit of that journey, about what she's doing after the shop closes. You miss a lot of that. You just kind of get told that when she meets up with Joe, you don't actually get too much of it. And then as I mentioned, when they get together at the end, so she goes out with Joe for lunch that day and it's very nice. And then he tells her how he feels and she clearly feels like similarly about Joe. And he tells her that knowing that later on that day he's going to reveal himself. And I don't know what he was playing at. I don't know if he was hoping that she'd choose him then or what, but he did put himself forward as Joe before they met up as the internet friends. The fact that when he shows up and it's him and she was like, I hoped it was you. I would have liked to see that in the movie. You know, I would have liked to see from her this kind of growing concern that, yes, you can see the growing attraction and friendship with Joe and Meg, but I would have liked to see anything that made her suspect or, like she said, hope, like kind of like, you know, the dream would be that, you know, she says, I wanted it to be you so badly.
A few connected dots would have been
I would have nice. Liked to or a see few moments some of that. Like, I don't know how you would stares. Have done that, but I really, the only thing that you get, because the whole time we know Tom wants Kathleen and Shop Girl, he knows they're the same person and he wants them to, you know, he's doing his best to kind of be the same person to her in life as he is online. And like you said, Arianna says maybe he was like trying to lampshade that connection to her. I would have liked, do you feel like there are any moments, Arianna, that I'm missing where you think that she has suspicions or that, or even just desires? Because when she says, I wanted it to be you, it's like, I mean, there's some great face acting. Before he wipes her face and says, don't cry, Shop Girl, like she kind of has this like twisted, like smiley frown where she's kind of processing the whole thing. And it you know, you can tell that she feels it was both surprising and inevitable. And it's, you know, it's just a lot. Like, you know, she does a lot of processing in that scene in a way that I think does tell a story. But I don't know, should there have been more from her perspective about rationalizing her attraction to the internet guy and Joe?
I think that this time I definitely noticed the nuances a lot more. Like, I do think that she has, like, when he brings the daisies, I feel like there's a moment of recollection, but also she's sick, so she's not, like, that's the moment where I feel like it becomes like clearest to her, but she's also like sick. Then when they're at the farmer's market, there's this moment, like, I think she definitely realizes she has feelings for Joe. Cause like there's this moment where she says, like, I can never date anyone who had like a boat. And then he goes, I have a boat.
Yeah.
And you see her face like, ooh.
Yeah, I definitely think she has feelings for Joe. I just more am like the whole, I wanted it to be you so badly. I'm kind of like, show me in the text where it said that prior to this moment. And I would have probably liked to see a little bit of that for me to, like, seeing more of that would have made me feel better about the weird Tom gaslighting, if you know what I mean. Like, seeing more from her that she hoped it was him would have made me feel better about the way that he had played it. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, just like some little glimmers of
how you would have shown it. Like, I don't know how you would have done it, but Brittany, how do you feel? Or do you just kind of accept the way that it falls out?
Well, I guess every alternative that I could think to propose would be a different movie. So
yeah, I agree. Yeah, I kind of know what you mean.
I think that I do accept the way that everything plays out, but I also agree that I think we could have used it, leaned so heavily on Joe in the back half of the movie that I think there could have been like maybe a beat more in addition to the scene where she's sick, where we just get like, because you feel so much from her in that scene, because like Joe's just, we're stuck on her in that perspective. Like, Joe's just sort of like puttering around the house and like fixing things up a little bit, but we're really focused on her in that scene. And I think that that does a lot, but it doesn't inform enough. Like, we needed like one more scene where they're
maybe
both
her
in
talking
it.
To someone else, like talking to the friend, like talking to one of like the girl who worked in the shop. Or
no, I don't even think it needed to be, it could have been the two of them, but I think the focus needed to be from her, because like when Joe comes into her space, it's when we're with her. So I think we needed one more scene with the two of them, but where she's grounded in the space and not him.
Interesting. It's I mean, ultimately, you know, you accept it. And I do think, yeah, she does a lot of work in that scene where he reveals, and in him as well, he's kind of like, he's got this guilty, like, well, this is it. There is a sense of inevitability to it, not just for the viewer. There is a sense of inevitability to it, I think, for both of them. Like, there is a sense of, had to be this way. And like, for him, he's kind of like, sorry if this is not how it works, but here I am. And for her, it kind of, I don't know, it's interesting. I skipped over this earlier because I missed it, but Brittany mentioned like that one of the things that makes this movie feel like different is the again from She Loves Me, which was the musical, was the sense of place about New York and going around New York. Obviously, this is like a very big New York movie. It's a very important streets of New York, specifically on the Upper West Side, where, you know, the setting is a real character in the film, like the way that New York works, the local businesses, the fact that there are like these little villagey areas in various neighborhoods, local businesses versus big businesses, and all of that kind of stuff. So, like, I guess my question about that is, like, do you guys like New York movies? Like, why does New York kind of inspire this in films? Like, what is it? Do you feel like any other city comes close to comparing? I mean, factually, it doesn't. New York is the most filmed city in the world, like in the universe. Even though movies are shot in LA, New York on location is the most filmed city in the world. So, but yeah, what do you guys feel about the sense of place in this movie as a New York movie? Or like, have you got anything that you would compare it to? Or, you know, just that whole idea of the city as a character. Brittany, you were there today, so why don't you start?
Yeah, I was there today. Well, I think that the thing about New York is it's really not that big, but it's huge. Yeah. So, like, you could turn every two blocks is something different. So there's these little pockets of just places that feel so much like home, but really in the grand scheme of things are part of something much bigger. So like even the shop around the corner and, you know, Fox Books, it's like, these are set in such a place where they can be built side by side. It's not like they're running you out of like a strip mall in the middle of like somewhere you need to drive to. It's like, these are places that foot traffic is driving.
I think the carless element, the fact that it is a, you know, it's a walking city. I mean, obviously there are cabs and stuff, but like the fact that it is a city where there's a lot of foot traffic, it does help with this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's something, it's a place where you can have something so one of a kind next to something that is on every street corner. So even back to like what you were talking about with the Starbucks, it's like, yeah, I'm sure there were like five other coffee shops she could have gone to before Starbucks.
It's interesting. Ariana, do you like New York movies? Does it like give you a fantasy sense of this place you haven't been? Or like, because for me, I before I ever went to New York, I love New York movies. And I'll say that like, I do feel like that off like a good New York movie feels like the city really is. And I don't really feel like that about any other movie that I've seen in any other city aside from People Like Us, which I think is the best like on location in Los Angeles movie that I've ever seen. I don't know if you've seen that movie with Chris Pine and Elizabeth Banks. New York, a good New York movie does actually feel like New York, whereas so many movies have like a fake element to the sense of place. Do you guys feel like that about any other movies? Ariana, you haven't been to New York. Cassie, you haven't been to New York. Danielle, you have. Obviously, you guys live in LA and Danielle lives in Chicago. So are there any like Chicago or LA movies that feel good to you in a sense of place way as well?
I've never been to New York. Do I like New York movies? I like Nora Ephron's version of New York. It feels very cozy. I know we talked about Notting Hill, and I know I said I didn't really care for it, but I do really like their version of London.
It's very accurate. I used to literally right around the corner from where that was filmed.
Nostalgia from when I studied abroad.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of like an LA rom-com, Valentine's Day. It's a terrible movie. but they do have a great scene at the end at the Venice Canals, and I love walking the Venice Canals.
Oh, I think, yeah, they do. That is a good scene. Again, the No Strings Attached is an LA movie that I think is pretty good. But People Like Us isn't a rom-com. It's a family drama. Like, it's about a brother and sister. That's a beautiful LA movie. If you've never seen it, you should see it. Go on.
I was going to say, so Chicago doesn't really get a lot of great movie exposure. It's something that I really don't like, because you can very clearly tell when something is not Chicago, or vice versa. If they use Chicago as a standard for something else, they like don't take away anything that is like iconically Chicago. thinking in terms of like the CW's Batwoman, like they use Chicago so extensively, but like not in a way where it's like, this could be Gotham. It's just very clearly Chicago. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I will say, the closest I feel anyone has gotten, with some exceptions, is Sense8.
We talked about that when we did the show.
Yeah, there are aspects of that, not the full thing, but there are aspects of it that like feel very at home and lived in. And so that kind of stuff makes me happy. Whereas like, I don't know, for New York movies, I don't mind them, but I feel like New York still feels so large and there's so many different perspectives that like, I don't have a certain feeling that is New York to me at this point. And it's also like, the last time I was in New York, I went around to a bunch of like Avengers filming locations, and it totally skews now the way that I see that movie. And so that movie kind of felt like New York to me before. And then after being to New York, like it doesn't feel like New York anymore.
Marvel's New York is not, it's definitely not the,
I mean, just in terms of, it's not even like what they were showing. It's just the way that they showed perspectives of things and the way that the camera was moving around the space. It was just strange.
I've been to Chicago. My favorite Chicago movie that I think feels like Chicago is High Fidelity. Have you seen it?
I have not seen that one.
So it's set in like a, I want to say it's set in like the Wicker Park kind of area of Chicago. It might be more like that. That is very much, that has a great sense of place for Chicago and filmed on location. And so I like that movie for Chicago. Like I said, People Like Us for LA. I will watch a movie that was filmed on location in New York purely because it was filmed on location in New York. Like I very much enjoy seeing that city on film, and there's so much that you could do with it. I don't know. It's interesting. You know, one of my favorite movies growing up, and the movie that made me fall in love with New York, was Home Alone 2, minus the Donald Trump cameo. That has a great sense of place in New York. There are just so many things that you can do with it, whether it's like small communities of different cultures or whether it's like the rich lifestyle. And I definitely love New York. A New York film is like a category of its own to me that I will watch purely because it was filmed on location in New York. But I don't know, maybe I'm weird like that. Cass, you haven't been there, but how do you feel about like the city via films? Like what are your feelings?
Well, weirdly, my impression of New York, I think I'm going to blame it entirely on the fact that I've watched so many Nora Ephron movies, is perpetual autumn. I just associate it with autumn leaves. Like I just picture like Central Park when I think of New York because of the movies that I watch. I just picture fall. Mm. And so it does give me that sort of that warmth. I think Ariana was mentioning it earlier. That sort of cozy warmth of the Nora Ephron version of New York. But yeah, without having been there, that is something that when I picture myself visiting, because I do plan to go there eventually. Mm. I think I'm going to have to go in the fall.
If you ever go, if you go with me, it won't be in the fall. I never go in the fall.
If you come here in the fall, all right, here's the caveat. You have to come well before, like, Halloween is when you should plan, because as soon as Halloween is over, I swear, walking through New York this past weekend, it is Christmas. It's Christmas.
Oh, wow. There's not nothing. The same. Like, it's,
yeah,
it's,
there is ever the lights are up. It is crazy.
I think Chicago is more of a fall city to me than New York, but yeah, New York's a summer, like, city to me.
Yeah, if you come, you would go, it would be a good time to go to, like, Brooklyn. There's more trees, first of all. There's like, yeah, unless you're going to Central Park, but also the trees are kind of like dead at this point. But I would say, like, around Halloween-ish time, because then the trees are turning in Central Park. You get, like, all your great park views, but, like, Bryant Park, the ice skating's up already. Like, you've missed that park completely because it's taken over, like, end of October for ice skating. And then, but if you're going to, like, neighborhoods, it's a little bit better. Like, Midtown is completely, it is there. I couldn't believe it. I was just like, I was walking around and, like, they have, like, obviously Macy's is set up because the parade is this week, but so they have, like, the big giant turkey over Macy's, and, like, the street is painted already and the stands are up for the parade, but you know, everywhere else they're ready to kick off the holiday season. Like, the Rockettes are performing already. Everything is full blown. Like, there was Christmas music, like, blasting out of, like, this pizza place. I was like, I am not ready for this. I'm not emotionally ready for this.
I mean, it's also a great Christmas city, though. Like, that's the thing. Yeah. It is that, like, London is my favorite city for a variety of reasons, but New York is the greatest city. Like, it's just so, because it's so dense and it's so, like, there's everything 24 hours a day that you could think of going on. It's so dense. It's so accessible. I mean, it's not accessible if you're in a wheelchair. The subway wheelchair stuff is terrible, but it's very accessible for an able-bodied non-driver. It's like everything takes 5 minutes, like not 5 minutes, everything takes like 20 minutes. And it's just really interesting. And I have been in there in the fall. Probably the first time I ever went there was in the fall, but I mainly have been there in like an April, May period, a July period, and then winter, like January and February. So I've seen it in like the depths of summer, like late July. It's disgusting. Like it's the heat and the way that everything's trapped in it's bad. Very deep summer is horrible. Spring, like April, May, when it's like still chilly, but like there's tulips out and it's stuff, that's great. It's like actual snow in January and February, like the city, like Leo and I, like when we went there to, last time we were there was in like February 2019, and one of the days we were there, it was a full snow day, and we went out after a show and we walked around Central Park in the snow until it got dark, and then came out by the plaza, like with the lights all over in the snow near the duck pond. And it was like, it's the best. It's just the best. But Brittany, what is your, do you have like a favorite New York movie that feels like the best to you?
No, I really, I think because...
Or a TV show?
No, I really don't think about it, to be completely honest, when I'm watching something, but I think it's just because I grew up here.
Yeah.
So, like, New York is not a...
fantasy,
like it's not a destination, well, because it's so accessible.
Yeah, that's,
and so,
I mean, that's the, I guess that's more the question. Like when you see New York on screen compared to the way that it is, what I mentioned before was like, I feel like the reason that it works so well is because it's like quite believable. Like it's like it doesn't feel like fakes. Like I feel like when you see New York, mostly it feels like quite accurate to how the city's unique character actually is. and it's not, it doesn't feel like a fake version of the city, I guess. And I was wondering if, like, that's something that you feel, like, more strongly in any movie, some movies rather than others. Like, is there anything you've seen that is filmed there but, like, feels like a totally fake version of the city, like, tone-wise? Or do you feel like usually New York is New York and it feels right?
Yeah, I mean, anything filmed in Midtown is usually the only thing that really bugs me about anything that they show filmed in Midtown is someone like stepping right out of a building, jumping in a cab and getting to where they need to be within 20 minutes. Because listen, that's
I've had to get out of cabs in Midtown and walk. I've been like, no, I'm getting out of here to wait.
It's faster to walk or take the subway. Like no New Yorker is doing that. No way.
Because there's a one-way system. Like that's the thing. There's like the streets have alternating one-way systems in and out of Midtown.
Yeah.
And if you get in a cab, like you're not going to get there faster in a cab than you would on foot because you're going to have to go like in a loop. Sorry, this is like, I have almost missed shows because of this. So yeah, it's.
So like those type of things like stick out and bug me. But otherwise, you know, and once you're like, once something is not taking place in Midtown, everything is pretty believable because neighborhoods are so different and unique that it's really, unless like you're from that neighborhood, like you could probably nitpick it, but anything is pretty much believable outside of Midtown because there's just so much of the city that you can keep discovering new things all the time.
Yeah. It also has a very unique light because of the building reflections, like the sun and the high rises and the tone of the way the light goes down in New York is pretty unique as well because there's a lot of brown stone. Like there's a lot of old buildings that are like a yellow and brown stone, and there's a lot of reflective buildings, and the way that it all combines to reflect the light onto the street level is like very, you can tell if something's set in New York but not filmed in New York just because of the light. And I feel the same way about London as well, like the light, the natural lighting of on location stuff for New York and for London and for LA is all not replicable really. So yeah, anyway, this is probably not that interesting to anyone else, so let's move on to our favorite scenes and favorite lines quickly from You've Got Mail. So favorite scenes from You've Got Mail. Mine was, I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's the one that always sticks out. Like if I thought about this movie and I hadn't seen it in 10 years, it's when Kathleen is in the Fox Books sort of crying over the fact her shop's closed, and she hears like an uncaring, or not uncaring, but like uneducated young attendant trying to help this unknowing customer who's here, like, I was here told to buy this book, what is it? And the customer's like, I don't know, I don't have anything to go on. And I mean, fair, I've worked in bookshops and someone being like, I was told this, and if I didn't know anything and I didn't have like a name, I'd be like, I've got no idea. And the fact that she kind of just turns around and, you know, while crying kind of gives this, you know, passionate information because of her experience with the children's books, that moment for some reason has always really stuck in my mind. I don't know why, but that's been the thing that I remembered off by heart, like between years of seeing the movie. So that was my choice. Danielle, what was yours?
I mean, in keeping with the theme of things that stuck in your mind, perhaps because it combines like the ideas of two things I don't normally like, again, children and old people. I really enjoyed the scene towards the beginning of the movie where Joe walks into the bookshop and he's with his aunt and his brother. And they're there trying to explain the family tree. That young actress who I didn't look her up, but like, I know I've seen her in other things. Mm-hmm. Like she has just such a great control over her facial expressions. And she was just so lovely. So that was my favorite scene.
I definitely remembered that one vividly as well. When she's like, when he's like, no, Annabelle is my aunt. And then later when he was like, look, I was just trying to do something nice for children who are related to me, basically, like the way that he kind of phrased it. Because, yeah, like he's like kind of in the uncle position over these two kids that have like a different family tree relationship, but it's kind of like an older family member who cares about them in a kind of slightly removed way. And I, that one stuck out for me as well. And it was just such a funny element to include. I think that's kind of a perfect example of like this being a really good rom-com in the com side, because there's absolutely no reason in the world for that to have been his aunt and his brother. He could have had a brother in the family business that had children. Like, he could have really been their uncle. The fact that they structured it and like to show that side of his family and the kind of weirdness was, had nothing to do with the romance plot at all, but it was just a cool character thing that it just made it just that much funnier. Cass, what was your favorite scene?
Mine was the entire publishing party. So
the pen dinner.
The dinner. So basically everything from the beginning with Kathleen and Joe being awkward when he first sees her there and realizes that she's going to figure out who he is, that he's Joe Fox, that he's not just nice man Joe that was in her store. That to then Joe, to Kathleen accusing him of renting child actors to pretend to be father and aunt. The way he's like taking all of the caviar and she's scraping it back off, like scraping it back onto the plate while he's talking. Then Joe being a jerk, and then all the way up to the end of that entire scene with Frank showing up and realizing that Joe is being a jerk and saying, how do you sleep at night? But then Patricia showing up, being completely unhinged, but also genuinely helpful, being like, oh, this is my pill situation that I recommend. Like every single thing that happened in that, every one of their characters.
Yeah, it was chaotic.
It's just chaos, and just it's every single character has such a distinct voice. And I feel like that scene really like showcases all of their voices in such a fun way and in such an interesting way. I just adore that scene.
I also really like the instant connection between Frank and Patricia, but the fact that they did not pair them up.
Yes,
same. Like, if you know what I mean, like, oh, my God, I'm really interested in you. Like, that it didn't end with, like, oh, actually, they'll end up together.
Yeah.
It was just genuine professional interest and, like, oh, I want to keep talking to you. Like, I
the way
I
they're really just sort of shaking that. Hands and being dragged away from each other.
Yeah, I really love that.
I love that scene so much.
Yeah. Arianna, how about you? What was your favourite scene in the film?
My favourite scene is when he brings her the daisies when she's sick. It's one of my favourite scenes of all movies all ever movies.
It's very nice, and it's structured well, isn't it, because he shows up with the flowers and you kind of don't know, like, that he knows she's sick. Like, you as the audience, like, you kind of go into the scene with a bit less context, and it's kind of like it unfolds what the situation it is that he heard she was sick. He heard it because of the staff member working there, and, you know, we kind of get the context building as it unfolds, as opposed to it being like exposition. I also really liked her hiding the mug in the newspaper basket when she's attempting to clean up, because it was just ridiculous.
It's also just such a charming thing that her favorite flowers are daisies, because she thinks they're friendly. They're my mom's favorite flower because she loves this movie.
Oh, that's so good. Brittany, how about you? What's your favorite scene in the movie?
Well, when I came to the dock, Ariana hadn't filled in her scene, and I had a feeling it was the scene, so I didn't take it. And so that is actually my favorite scene, is the sick scene. But my second favorite is, I love watching Joe at the fall festival, and I love the shot of Tom Hanks just on that little train. And then also when he sticks his head in the turkey cardboard, like wood cutout, I think.
Train. With the kid. Yeah, it was just, it was good. Favorite quotes. Again, like, this movie, every line is pretty much killer, and even down to like the tiny insequential little humorous lines. But so my favorite line was actually in that sickness scene where they're talking about the breakdown of her business and the shop. And, you know, how he was kind of trying to apologize. You know, they're coming to terms with the fact that they're kind of interested in each other as human beings, but that this business thing still happened. And they talk about, you know, change being a good thing, you know, or whatever. But what really stuck me was the bit where he's saying it was just business and he's, you know, it wasn't personal. And she says to you, like, it wasn't personal to you. It was personal to me. But the thing that really got to me was when she said, whatever anything else is, it ought to begin by being personal. Whether that's like a business or a project or just anything you do in life. Like, I honestly feel like that's like a great mission statement for life, and that anything that is successful generally comes from being, having a personal, passionate element to it. It's also kind of the mission statement that we have for Subjectify Media as well. Like, it's, as a line on its own, as an idea on its own, I feel like it's hugely profound, and it kind of makes me want to know the story of how Fox Books started, you know, like, if that was ever a factor for them. And just, yeah, it's just a great single line thesis for the world. I loved it. Danielle, what was yours?
So mine is one of the ones that you would, I think, classify as inconsequential, but yeah. It is, what is it with men and the Godfather?
Oh my God. It was so funny. That whole exchange, with the going to the mattresses, and when he was like, when he comes back and he's given her that advice later, when Frank's like, do you know what this is? And he's like, yeah, the Godfather. And I wrote down, speaking in quotes from The Godfather is not a personality trait, but I do speak in quotes constantly from other movies, so I might as speak. But, yeah, it's true. That little tracking joke that then threw back to Frank and her being like, oh, my God, was a very funny element.
Yeah, very funny. And, like, again, not much has changed, although it's not The Godfather anymore. It's, I don't know, you name it.
It's still The Godfather.
I'm just like thinking of what I see on dating apps and stuff. Like, it's
Fight Club.
There are, yes, it's Fight Club for
so
sure.
So here's the thing. I just want to say one thing about Fight Club is so not relevant. Fight Club is a fantastic movie, but if a guy like is like, my favorite movie is Fight Club, you can almost 100% guarantee that he does not understand what the movie is actually about. And it's a red flag, even though it's an amazing movie.
Yeah.
That's a whole other story, but yeah, it's kind of like, it's a great movie. But if a guy says it's his favorite movie, he probably doesn't understand it. Anyway, Cass, you had an insequential quote in passing, which I think is like one of the funniest things in the movie. So why don't you mention that one before doing your serious one?
I will. So my favorite, like, just random little moment is when the business in the store is starting to get a little bit slow. George says, "This place is a tomb. I'm going to the nut shop where it's fun."
It was just so random. It's so random, and it's like, and it's great because the nut shop's established earlier, like, so yeah. It's like one of the neons that you see, and it's just so funny. And I think that it's just,
I just love the idea. Yeah. Storming out, like stomping out of the store, off to his to hang out with his buddies at the nut store.
There was another great one like that where the girl who also she's the girl from Miss Congeniality, right? She's the Miss Rhode Island from Miss Congeniality.
Oh, yes, she is. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's her. She's great. But when she's like telling him off about the rent control department, like, oh my God, stop bringing it up. That's such like a stupid angle to take. It's like when people brag about being tall. But Cass, sorry, go on to your proper one.
So that was just my secondary one. But my the main one was, when you read a book as a child, it becomes part of your identity in a way that no other reading in your whole life does. Which is something Kathleen says in the scene where Joe first comes into the store with the two kids, and she's sort of getting carried away with talking about, you know, how she came to be working in the bookstore and that sort of stuff. And I think in terms of her character, sort of where she ends up writing like a children's book and that's sort of a through line. This particular line just that just like really resonated with me, and it's also just something that's true of life as well, like not just books that you read as a child, but any sort of media that you consume as a child is going to be something that becomes really integral
Yeah, I guess to like how you see the world and like kind of like
how you relate to other people,
how your empathy ends up getting built, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's a really nice thing, and the thing about a nut store. Those are my favorites.
All right, Ariana, what was your favorite quote from the film, at least on this watch? Because I'm sure that you've had favorites on other watches.
Yeah, on this watch, it's the one that made me look at the whole movie differently. But it's when that old lady, I forgot her name.
Birdie or
yes, something. she tells Kathleen, closing the store is the brave thing to do. You're daring to imagine that you could have a different life.
Mm.
And I just think that's so lovely and such a great way to look at endings, or even like we have such a negative opinion on like quitting things.
Endings.
Yes. Yeah. But seeing it as brave or a new beginning is really nice.
Yeah, it is. There was actually a quote in the film about change, like that Kathleen says, that she says, people are always telling you that change is a good thing, but all they're saying is that something that you didn't want to happen at all has happened. And that's also very valid. Like, but we do as a nation, as a society, really struggle with change and with endings and with death. And basically, yeah, permanent change is something that we as a culture really struggle with. And I don't think that fighting it is the path to happiness. So it is an interesting angle to take. And good, a kind of that. That's why I think I like that the shop did close and stuff like that. Brittany, your turn.
So my favorite line is right before Joe realizes that it's Kathleen, and he's about to go into the shop to meet her, and it's just like this moment of like describing something that makes sense completely in your head, but you're telling someone else, like an external person, out loud for the first time. And so like you can completely come off crazy, but you're so caught up in like just your feelings in the moment that I just love it. And it's so romantic and it makes my heart hurt. But it is sort of like a throwaway line because I like never hear anyone talking about it. But when I was like skimming the transcript, I was like, oh my God, this scene, like I forgot how much this scene is like, it's just so good. But basically Joe is like, Kevin, this woman is the most adorable creature I've ever been in contact with. If she turns out even to be as good looking as a mailbox, I'd be crazy not to turn my life upside down and marry her.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's great. And it does. And it clinches that important thing about like a connection beyond the face and all of that kind of stuff. And I mean, that's like, you haven't seen Ted Lasso, Brittany. Who here has seen Ted Lasso? Cass, I know you have.
I'm admittedly not caught up on it. I'm through like episode 2, I think, in season 2. Okay. But it's wonderful.
Well, next episode, you're going to learn that there is an app that plays called Banter in Ted Lasso. That is basically was set up as a plot device in the show. It's one of the brands that ends up sponsoring the team. It's set up as a plot device for this exact reason, for anonymous dating. It is an app like Tinder designed, but to be pictureless, so you're connecting with people based on just dialogue, no pictures. And they actually do a rom-com episode in season 2 about, it's episode 5 of season 2. You'll love it when you see it, Danielle. That does play with this. It plays with Rebecca is on the app and she's boss girl and she meets someone, LND152, and starts an ongoing relationship with them. And that becomes a big plot point in season 2. And so there is an episode of Ted Lasso that spoofs like many rom-coms. Like it has lots of lines from different rom-coms and it kind of spoofs it. But the Banter app is a season-long factor and it's all based on this movie, on You've Got Mail. And that, I think...
The 152 sounds like it is.
Oh, it's meant to be. It's okay. Yeah, it's Boss Girl and LND152. Like, it's literally meant to be based on this. And the rom-com episode is literally them almost speaking in rom-com quotes the whole episode. Like, Ted has a whole rom-com thesis, and they basically do lots of scenes that spoof lots of different rom-coms. It's amazing. But the through line from that that carries the whole season is the You've Got Mail plot, which is an anonymous picture-free dating app that is meant to replicate this kind of relationship where you're connecting with someone only based on texting, like in words and stuff like that, like no face, no body judgment. And I think that what this quote of Britney's is about is really important. And one of the reasons that early internet was important, when people weren't necessarily using it to try and date and they weren't doing picture profiles, it was just about connecting to people on the most base level of like conversation and connection. And I'm really glad this quote about her looking like a mailbox was included, because despite the fact that she looks like Meg Ryan, I believe him. Like, I believe that it's like just a personality and conversation connection, and that's the key to why it matters, I guess. And I think that's the key to like why you would go above and beyond the fact they had this conflict in person, because, you know, that on your most base level of communicating with another human being, you are connecting better than you've connected with anyone ever. So,
and it ought to begin by being personal, to bring it back to your favorite quote.
Yeah. So I love that. And yeah, I'm sure that there's going to be listeners who have watched Ted Lasso season 2 and wanted to talk about the reference there. So I just wanted to mention it, and that seemed like a good moment. I guessed very early on who was on the other end of Rebecca's app, and I was correct, and I am very happy with it, but others may not be, but we'll see. You will find out within the season. That is that, unless there's anything else that anyone wants to say about You've Got Mail before we finish up.
Nope.
I think we're good.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so just a reminder that you can reach out to us on Twitter if you've got any thoughts about the episode on re_watchable, or you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. We had a couple of tweets, which was from some of our listeners in advance of this movie. One from Emily Rugburn, who is PennyLane516, who said, "This is one of my favorite movies. It's a quiet classic, and my family usually watches it on or around Thanksgiving just for the grocery store scene. The movie is a great retelling of Shop Around the Corner and sort of a companion to Sleepless in Seattle." So, yeah, we discussed that a bit. And, yeah, apparently this is a Thanksgiving movie, even though it only has the one Thanksgiving scene. So that's why we're doing it today. And Hannah Grace, local Duchess, has said, "I adore this movie, but to this day I maintain it would not work if Tom Hanks wasn't the main guy. If you think about it too long, it falls apart. But during the movie, you're so charmed by New York's and books and AOL, you forget the main guy is an ass." Lol. Looking forward to you guys' thoughts. So I think we all agree that, yeah, it took someone like Tom Hanks to pull off the kind of more dodgy side of the Joe plot. Do you think he's like the only one, or like just...
Well, we already talked about this a little bit, but I just wanted to briefly say that I feel like it's not just his charm, it's his gravitas, which is really hard to be both charming and have gravitas to you.
Yeah. I'm going to have a good think about like if there's even anyone comparable if you made this movie in 2021, but yeah. So if you rate us on iTunes, more people will find the podcast and we will be able to be here again. So if you go on iTunes and rate us on Apple Podcasts, then Karen will send you a bouquet of daisies and newly sharpened pencils, which I think is a much nicer incentive than many of our Karen incentives. So you really should get on that. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, a bunch of places. If you go on our main page via Subjectify, the Audio Boom account, which is the actual host of our podcast, will show all of the resources, all of the different apps that you can get the podcast in. So hopefully one of those works for you. We will be back in a couple of weeks with our next special on The Matrix. So that'll be me and Brittany, Karen and Kendra doing the third part of The Matrix trilogy, which we've been doing in honor of Sense8, the Wachowskis, and that's what we've been doing interspersed with our holiday specials. And then after that, we'll be doing a Christmas holiday special like we did last year for Muppet Christmas Carol. We probably won't do the Muppet Christmas Carol again, though all I wanted to do for like 5 weeks is watch it. We will be doing another Christmas movie, possibly revisiting some of the ones that were our second choice last year, and doing that for your Christmas. And then we will be back in 2022 with a new proper TV series, normal rewatchable schedule. Fingers crossed anyway. Until then, thank you for hanging out with us to talk about You've Got Mail, and we will let you go. So until then, I've been Natalie.
I'm Danielle.
I'm Cass.
I'm Mariana.
I'm Brittany.
Okay, until then, happy Thanksgiving, guys, and bye-bye.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Bye.
Bye.
I call myself so very lucky just to have some company. Share a cup of tea with me. I take my puppy everywhere. La 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 la, I wouldn't care. But we would stay away from crowds with signs that said no dogs allowed. Oh, we, I know we'd never bite me. Bite.